You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
So there's this tension between this messianic ideology of the one world hegemon and the reality which is built every day today, which is a world which is multipolar. And by consensus, the countries creating that alternative do agree on the crucial principle, which is there are different paths to development, and each one gets to choose his own. Sovereignty is crucial. You do not interfere in the internal affairs of a country, and relationship between those countries shall be ruled by international law. These are three principles which are absolutely, emphatically not acceptable to the Anglo-Zionists, and they consider them, and I would argue correctly so, as existential threat to their way of life.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Andrei Rajovsky, who blogs as The Saker. Today's show, Superpower Confrontation in Syria. It's not over. The Saker is an expert in military analysis, intelligence issues, Russian geopolitics, and traditional Christian orthodoxy. He worked as a military analyst in Europe until he lost his career due to his vocal opposition to the Western-sponsored wars in Chechnya, Croatia, Bosnia, and Kosovo. He returned to the United States and has been blogging since 2007 as The Saker. He is the author of The Essential Saker, From the Trenches of the Emerging Multipolar World, and his newest, The Essential Saker 2. Saker, welcome back.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
On April 14th, the U.S., the U.K., and France launched a joint massive strike on Syria, justifying their actions with the alleged use of chemical weapons in Douma on April 7th. According to the Russian Defense Ministry, the Syrian Air Defense Forces shot down 71 of 103 missiles launched. The U.S. denies that missiles were intercepted. In any case, do we know what targets were actually hit in the U.S. missile strike on Syria?
Yeah, I think we do. What were hit were two buildings not far away from Damascus. There apparently were four, I think, airfields targeted, and possibly one more building, I would need to look it up, in Homs. So we have a pretty good idea of what was targeted, yes. I think I have to say the following thing here. We have to completely separate facts from ideology or propaganda or politics. I mean, if we look at the consequences and the way this strike was conducted, we have to function on two planes which simply don't even intersect anymore. There is all the reality of what actually took place, which first and foremost needs to be said. For American point of view, this was, again, basically a symbolic attack. If the Americans wanted to be serious about it, they would have gone about it in a different way. They would have totally constructed their entire operation a different way. So it was, from the onset, deliberate that it would be symbolic. And it kind of makes sense, because the official theory was that they would destroy the Syrian chemical weapons production facilities, which I think anybody with a little bit of critical thinking understands doesn't exist. So when you set out to destroy something which doesn't exist, you are almost 100%, well, I mean, you are guaranteed a success, because after you destroy that which doesn't exist, still doesn't exist, therefore it's a stunning success. Syrians do not have a sarin production facility. They do have chlorine, which is used even in sewing pools, so this is not a chemical weapon. But if they had tried to strike a real military chemical warfare production factory, the consequences on the ground would have been absolutely dramatic, just as was the case last year when they claimed that they bombed the airport where these chemical munitions, which don't exist, were stored. And you could see that the very next morning after the so-called successful strike, Russians were driving around in open jeeps and filming that airport. That would have been impossible if CERN had been, or VX or something like that had been stored there. So there is, on one level, if you want, a completely symbolic action, which was designed by the Americans to be symbolic. Then, of course, there was the failure of most of these missiles to reach the target, but I think the Americans could have predicted that. Because the Americans have a very good idea of how effective Syrian air defenses are. The Russians were not involved in that case. Well, it's just a matter of basic math. For instance, if it takes one missile to shoot down one other missile, one anti-missile to shoot one down, and you know that I have two, well, just shoot three. You will lose your first two to my 100% effective two, and then your third one will hit. This is basic math, and the Americans could easily have done that. They could have saturated the Syrian defenses. They didn't. So from the onset, it was a deliberate symbolic strike, and if it is indeed true from the military point of view, it was pretty laughable. But I think the Americans knew that that would be the outcome.
The claim that Assad would gas his own people doesn't make any logical sense, and a missile attack on a chemical factory or storage facility would poison thousands of people with toxic clouds, which you've just pointed out. You have written that facts and logic no longer matter. All that matters are perceptions. How do perceptions pertain to this latest U.S. missile attack on Syria?
Well, we heard Donald Trump calling it the perfect strike. That's typical perceptions. We heard all sorts of the kind of American triumphalism, you know, we're the best, we're number one, we have the best military. All that stuff is nonsense. Everybody who's in the know on military affairs knows that's nonsense, but, you know, that's what's important. There are other things at work which are much more serious. For instance, it is a fact that if you strictly look what the Russians had said, the statement by General Gerasimov, he said that if Russians were attacked, they would shoot back and destroy the missiles and even the carriers. A lot of was made out of that statement. He never said that the Russians would defend all of Syria. They don't have the means actually to do it physically. I mean, they just have enough to cover themselves in the north, in Khmeimim, Latakia, and Tartus. So there never was an option of Russians, say, if the Americans had attacked downtown Damascus or made a more robust military attack on the Syrian military, the Russians had never said that they would actually respond and start shooting at U.S. forces in that case. But the perception here again, never mind what the Russians actually said, the perception is the Americans bombed a Russian ally again with impunity. That perception is very important. It does two things. It first of all puts pressure on the Russians to next time do something out again of the real world, reality world, and sort of make something significant in the symbolic perception world. It also, unfortunately, gives the U.S. side that sense of, we did a great job, look what we did. And you can interpret what happened in two ways. You can say, like some do, for instance, that the Americans blinked. I use that deliberately, that blinked thing, which is stupid and reckless when we're talking about war between, you know, nuclear powers. But okay, let's use that kind of language and say, let's see which side blinked. Well, you can say that the Americans did it, because the Americans blinked because they bypassed the Russians completely. They chose a symbolic strike. They didn't have the again, I'm using deliberately the wrong language here, the courage to engage from the Mediterranean, they did from far away, the Red Sea, etc. So the Americans clearly show that they're afraid of the Russians. You can flip that completely around and say, the Russians blinked. The Americans beat their ally up right in front of them, and they didn't do anything about it. For all their rhetoric, you know, they are just hot air and didn't take any action. So you see, you can flip that in this realm of ideology and propaganda. You can say anything you want, and that's mostly where this is headed, and that's what's scary about it. Because the more we go into that kind of discussion of political, like campaign talk, that's what it reminds me of, the more we're ignoring the really frightening realities on the ground. And I think that what I want to mention too, first of all, what's taking place is a complete wholesale abandonment of the very principles of international law. I mean, the U.S. is, they like to use the word rogue state. That is the ultimate rogue state. Well, with Israel, the two of them. They basically overtly, with no shame, in your face, violate every single rule of international law and tell the rest of the planet basically what you're going to do about it. That kind of thuggery is frightening because it basically pushes towards the law of the jungle. And if it were to be successful, it would be world hegemony, but it's not going to be successful. So that pushes basically the world to people, forcing them to fight back militarily. I mean, the purpose of law is not justice, is to manage conflict. That's why the UN Security Council was created. That's why the UN was created. That's the main function, is to avoid wars. By trampling completely upon the UN Charter and the international law, the Americans are basically saying war is the way international relations are going to be fought. That's the first problem. The second problem is, for every one of those even symbolic operations that the Americans get away with, it brings us closer to less symbolic operations. There are rumors that some say Trump, some say Pompeo wanted to actually strike Iranian and even Russian targets in Syria. And the official version now is this: James Mattis said no. So we have a mad dog calming out the even madder, even crazier people there. That's truly frightening. If James Mattis is the current symbol for restraint and rationality, God help us all. And these are the real dangers of what's coming out of the situation. Not the size of the clouds or non-existing chemical weapons facilities. All of that is just pure nonsense. Like the Skripal case, it's another case of absolute cheap, poorly orchestrated false flags. Again, the problem is the consequences.
You just brought up the United Nations. The recent Russian-sponsored resolution at the UN Security Council to have the UN endorse the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, investigation of the April 7th Duma incident did not receive UN approval. It was blocked by the U.S. and its allies. Even without a UN endorsement, the OPCW investigation into the incident will move forward. Significantly, the attacks occurred before the OPCW could examine the alleged chemical weapons crime scene. Have the missile attacks obliterated the so-called crime scene?
No, not really, because my understanding is that the main place to investigate that so-called chemical attack would have been the hospital where the non-existing patients were supposed to be treated. But the Russians got there even before they investigated the place. I mean, the Americans did not strike that hospital. So it's not an attempt to literally do the same thing as they did with the Skripal animals, which is to incinerate them in order to, basically tamper with evidence. And conduct obstruction of justice at a grand scale. However, again, you're asking the question about reality, and I'll push you back to the world of illusion. What this really means is that the United States is sending a message to the OPWC, which is, you don't matter, we don't care about you. You can even send your investigators there, screw you, we're going to do whatever the hell we want without even waiting for results. That is a powerful message. It's not so much concealing what was done, because frankly, even if they had found nothing, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So, you could always claim, well, they didn't find it because their methodology wasn't good or because whatever. You can find a number of reasons to explain that away. The main thing was to show, basically, not the United Nations Security Council, most definitely not Russia, as I think Pompeo said himself, not even the OPWC, nobody has a veto rights over what we do. That's the key thing. The key message the United States is sending to the entire planet is, none of you, all of you, have to obey, accept, kneel, bow before us, and we do whatever the hell we want. Even if it's done symbolically, the message is accepted and the world behaves accordingly. I mean, the United Nations Security Council refused to condemn strikes which were executed in violation of the very authority of that UN Security Council. That is tantamount to a judge refusing to take action against somebody who is guilty of contempt of court. I mean, that's where we're at. They're taking it. Same way the Western democracies are taking the fact that illegal wars are engaged in without, consultation with parliaments. That's ignored. It's all basically a wholesale dismantling of every single principle of law, national law and international law, and that's extremely important.
I'm speaking with author and military analyst, The Saker. Today's show, Superpower Confrontation in Syria. It's not over. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Didn't Russia announce that they had discovered preparations underway for the staging of some kind of a false flag chemical attack in Syria to try and set up the Syrian government? What did the Russians say they had discovered?
They had discovered, yes, they did. They said that they knew that the White Helmets were involved, that they're bringing in the equipment. What happened was most likely is that they were not... Okay, let's backtrack here. I think the Americans did not expect the Russians and the Syrians to win militarily so rapidly in Ghouta and Douma. And what happened was the preparation was for more convincing, actually, with the use of chemical weapons attack there in order to trigger an intervention which would save the good terrorists. The problem is that the Syrians were too fast. They didn't have the time to engage in that, and therefore they had to botch it. So what they actually did, they didn't actually use chemical munitions and then make a real false flag. They actually invented the event based on a single video made inside the hospital, and that was good enough for that. So again, you could make fun and it seems to be that the people behind that were the British. That's what the Russians are saying now, the British Special Services. Now, you can make fun of them and saying, well, they botched the job. But I would say, so what? The fact that the Russians announced it ahead, even Nikki Haley announced that before even in the United Nations Security Council, she said it. She said, if the Syrians use chemical munitions and the Security Council does not authorize, you know, some kind of action, then we'll do it on our own. She told it straight to the face of the Security Council members. So it was announced. It's all completely clear. But here's the beauty of it in an evil sense. In spite of that, they still went ahead and did it, and nobody almost nobody had anything to object about it. So that's a statement of power. The fact that their pretext is so poorly crafted actually, in a way, makes it stronger because their case is so laughable, like the Skripal, doorknob, buckwheat, delivery through air vents and even through drones, etc. They had all sorts of, they would never recover. Turns out they both recovered. The animals didn't die. I mean, all of it is laughable. It would be a bad, bad book. But yet they acted on it. The fact that the Anglo-Zionist hegemony gets to use that kind of bad pretext and gets away with it is a statement of its true power, politically speaking.
And who are the White Helmets?
They're just basically... the Western Special Services have all sorts of... They always had, subsidiaries that operated under a different name. It could be National Endowment for Democracy. It could be, Radio Liberty in Europe. They are just the latest version. Basically, they are local good terrorists who just make videos and provide false flag footage for the Western media. That's basically what they are. They are financed by the Anglo powers, and their role is just to do that, basically, for false flagging.
You have written that the commander of CENTCOM was quoted as having said, quote, "We will do what we are told," end quote. So then, if the U.S. military is doing what they are told, who do you think is calling the shots in this missile attack on Syria?
That's a very complicated question. I asked two friends of mine who are very well informed. I asked them, do they think that there's a general up there in the, National Security Council, White House, Pentagon, on that level, the Joint Chiefs, who would have the courage of the kind of people, Fallon or Mike Mullen, who would say no? They were under the opinion that no, there is nobody. Now, the official rumor says that Mattis opposed it. Maybe. I don't know what happened. I don't think anybody... I mean, some people know, but I certainly don't know what happened really behind closed doors. In theory, the military has to say we will do whatever we're ordered. I mean, that is one of the principles of democracy, is that the military doesn't act on its own, but in the service of the legally elected government. But in reality, we all know that it's not that simple. They have a lot of power, actually. If they take a united stance and say, don't do that, the president, particularly an extremely weak one like Trump, can't do much. So it leaves, nutcases like Bolton, like Pompeo. These guys are truly crazy. And I think it is plausible. I'm not saying this is what happened, but it is plausible that Mattis and others in uniform just told them, guys, you're nuts, and we're not going to do that kind of stuff. And officially, you know, it's a call to debate. But it could be also the basically American generals doing the right thing and being responsible. But how long can they do that? That I don't know.
Vladimir Putin threatened severe consequences for escalation of U.S. aggression in Syria. So far, the only reaction from Russia has been verbal. In your article, Alas, It's Far From Over, you examine three possible avenues of response available to Russia, political, economic, and military. What dilemma does Russia face when deciding how to fight back against U.S. aggression in Syria?
Okay, let's look at each one of them in order. Political, what does that mean? Basically, denouncing the United States as a rogue state, violator of international law, that bases its actions on grotesquely non-credible false flags, attacks sovereign nations, etc. The Russians have been doing that. The point is nobody cares. Nobody cares. That's an ineffective. I mean, appealing to decency, common sense, logic, you know, values of Western civilization, all that, nobody cares. It's the same civilization who has Guantanamo still open. You know, it's the same that basically uses lies, you know, all the forms of lies that we heard, all the... We have a culture of lies and indifference to the truth right now, in which Russian protests make no sense. So you have little countries like Bolivia who can agree with Russia. Even China is kind of taking a zigzagging, very low-key position. So-called Russian allies like Belarus and Kazakhstan have nothing to say. I mean, the Russians are kind of on their own. Not really, but they're, you know, very isolated. And they're not going to achieve anything by just protesting. So the next thing would be economic retaliation. Russia is too small, too isolated. She doesn't have the means to do that. The key actor here that could have and still could actually become important is China. But China has decided to wait it out and let the Russians deal with the problem on their own. So economically, Russia can't do much. Plus, the U.S. administration is pushing towards severing ties between Russia and the West anyways. So, you know, some people say, well, let's stop selling energy to the Europeans. Let's see what happens, how they're going to like it. Well, I think the people might not like it, but the leaders of countries such as Poland or the Baltics or the American leaders are going to love it. They've been pressing for it. They want Nord Stream 2 to be stopped. So Russian sanctions somewhere are exactly what the U.S. is doing anyway. So is that really a deterrent to U.S. actions? I don't think so. Which leaves us with the last. The last is military action. Now, here, Russia has a double problem, is that, first of all, the United States does not have credible boots on the ground in the Middle East. Okay, if you look at U.S. allies there, they're basically Israel and Saudi Arabia. Those two countries excel at two things, shooting civilians and buying very expensive high-tech gear. That is not sufficient to be a credible force on the ground. And when these two countries were engaged on the ground, I think of Israel and Lebanon, or the Saudis in Yemen, they actually showed pitiful performance. So the U.S. tried to make some kind of base for themselves with the Kurds. That didn't work either. The Iraqis stopped the first one, and Turks stopped the second one. So the problem is that Russia really could, if Russia intervened more heavily and start taking military retaliatory action against the U.S. or our forces allied with the United States, very rapidly the U.S. would have either need to attack Russia and Russia territory proper because the Russian force in Syria is too small, and secondly, not having boots on the ground and not being a credible conventional force pushes a country in a situation of weakness like the U.S. is towards using nuclear weapons. So what we're really saying is if Russians use military means to actually extract a price from the U.S., making them pay, say, by attacking a U.S. base or sinking or even striking some kind of ship, Russia would be risking nuclear war with the United States. Is that responsible? I don't think so. That's Russia's dilemma. She doesn't have a good option.
What do you think was the goal of the Anglo-Zionist attack on Syria?
Well, it's a combination, as always with the U.S. It's not a single goal. It's a combination of things. The bigger picture, really, well, first of all, is to kind of stay in Syria, because Trump had made a silly statement, from his point of view, that they're going to get out. And he was immediately corrected by his, quote-unquote, advisors. That's a way of proving that we're staying there. No. I was, you know, misunderstood, or like W said, misunderestimated. And we're staying. So that's the tactical local thing, to show that we will spoil and try to make you pay for your successes in creating a conference on Syria and in the trilateral Astana agreement, et cetera. I mean, there's a local component to it, but there's a bigger one. The bigger one is to prove to the world that the U.S. still is the world hegemon. And Trump began that with a DPRK, threatened all sorts of things. We had this ridiculous talk about my red button is bigger than yours. And it all ended up in an embarrassment. So what they did, they quickly covered it up, forgot about it, sort of almost as if it never happened, even though he did threaten them with a formidable armada. And, you know, remember those articles about U.S. special forces taking out the North Korean leadership and, you know, the disarming nuclear strikes, all that nonsense? It's all gone now. Basically, the North Koreans managed to stare down the U.S. and the U.S. couldn't do it because the local allies of the U.S., Japan and South Korea, were horrified by this prospect. So right now, they're looking desperately for a sign of manhood and still capability for world hegemony. So that's why we saw Trump go on TV and has this... He looked, it's called in the U.S., he doesn't look like a nutcase, it's called looking presidential. When you come out and say, well, we decided to take action and order our magnificent armed forces to blah, 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 blah. That is what sells. That gives that impunity, image of impunity and arrogance, which is now considered presidential in the United States. That, I think, is a far more important goal. Third, humiliate Russia, because Russia right now is standing up to the United States, and there is a need to make the Russians look as weak as possible, particularly when they objectively are not that weak, and actually, in many ways, are stronger than the U.S. So there's, again, remember I said the two planes, the reality plane and the ideology delusional plane, were functioning very much in that other non-reality-based plane. That's where that had a major impact.
What strategic or national interest does the United States actually have in busting up Syria?
Well, to the extent that via the neocons, the United States is basically Israel's pit bull. This asking the wrong question. The real question is, how does Israel want to use the United States for its own goals in Syria? And then it's absolutely clear what's going on. What's going on is that basically, you remember General, Clark predicted a number of countries would engage. It's to remove a secular, pluralistic, and fairly functional system by ideally putting the crazies in power there, the bad or good terrorists, doesn't matter, thereby justifying Israeli action. First, they want chaos around themselves to be comparatively stronger. Secondly, they want a pretext to intervene outside their borders. And third, very, very importantly, they want Muslims to kill each other. So the idea is to unleash the Wahhabi crazies against their most important enemy, which is Hezbollah in Lebanon and Iran, really. The real action is always around Iran in the Middle East, between Iran and Israel. So the U.S. now having become basically a host for the Zionist parasite that's sitting on top now is basically used as a pit bull to do that on behalf of the Israelis, because they don't have the means to do that. And the United States by themselves, it's actually extremely counterproductive. They are allied with the wrong people. They're making themselves irrelevant. I mean, think of the move. Of a recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I mean, there couldn't be possibly be worse PR in the Middle East or the Arab Muslim world, and they did it. So I don't think the United States is pursuing any kind of national interest. And as a matter of fact, I don't think the United States has much of a foreign policy at all, other than the insistence that we're the world hegemon and everybody has to bow to the U.S. I think that's the only sort of, you know, the exceptionalism. That's about the only thing. Messianic exceptionalism, that is the idea. Nothing else.
I'm speaking with author and military analyst, The Saker. Today's show, Superpower Confrontation in Syria. It's not over. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You may mentioned General Wesley Clark and his speech about having been told by the Pentagon of a plan to take down 7 countries in 5 years. Is the taking down of Bashar al-Assad and the nation-state of Syria consistent with the Oded Yunon plan for the greater Israel?
Yeah, of course it is. Okay, there's 2 countries left which are really a problem for Israel, which was Syria and Iran. They don't have what it takes to take on Iran. They really don't, certainly not by themselves. And Syria is closer. And Syria is also, if you want, the rear base for Hezbollah in many ways. So they're going step by step, and the front line would be Syria. And basically, the way the British Empire used the Gurkhas, the Israelis are using the U.S. to basically as shock troops to go forward. And the problem is that these, unlike the Gurkhas, the U.S. is not very effective at doing that. I mean, they failed. In Syria, they failed. They failed because of the action of a really tiny Russian contingent, and the Iranians also on the ground made a big difference, as did Hezbollah. These are troops on the ground that can actually fight. And the U.S. and Israel don't have the equivalent. That's their dilemma. That's why they're so frustrated. That's why they have to resort to symbolic strikes and rhetoric, because they really don't have the means to intervene in Syria and really reverse the course of the war there and make it possible for the good and bad terrorists to completely eliminate the government of Syria.
Do you think that getting away with this strike with no repercussions so far will encourage more aggression?
Yes, I do.
Russian reinforcements, warships laden with tanks, military trucks, and armored patrol boats have been spotted cruising in the Bosphorus Straits en route to Syria. So Russia has something in mind in Syria.
Yes, Russia has a couple of things in mind. First of all, to try to protect its tiny force as best can be. Remember, that force is pretty far away from Russia, actually. Russia is not at all comparable to the U.S. military. Russian projection capabilities are nowhere near what the U.S. has. So for the Russians, it's a massive logistical undertaking to even deploy a task force there and then to protect it as best can be. But I think the more important part is there's a second level, which is to strengthen the Syrians. And that is the correct response, actually, to everything that's going on. It appears that the Syrians actually did a pretty good job with their defenses, admittedly against a fairly symbolic strike. But basically, if one side can escalate, so can the other. What the Syrians now desperately need is more modern air defense systems, particularly the short-range combined missile and gun systems that are ideal against cruise missiles. Everybody speaks always about the S-400s, and they are very impressive systems, but shooting down cruise missiles is not their primary task. It's not what they're best at. There's a different system which is less known called Panzer. It's extremely effective, road mobile, impossible to predict where it is, and it has a formidable capability against cruise missiles. And since cruise missiles are the prime weapon that the Anglo-Zionists can and will and have been using against the Syrians, the Russians need to flood that place with those kind of systems. That is the correct response. And then the second thing is the Syrians need to defend themselves. And why, even if there are some Syrians who would look like Russians, be Slavs, and speak Russian inside the actual air defense system, like, you know, the Russians were part of the war in Korea, for instance, it has to be officially the systems in order to not escalate. If you have plausible deniability, you fight by means of proxy. If both sides even know, but you still have that, you know, fig leaf of it's not the Russians who are shooting back as the Syrians, then the punishment meted out against them will be against the Syrians and not against the Russians. And the point here is not to preserve Russian lives and say Syrians are expendable. But the point is to avoid a direct escalation between both sides, which would lead to nuclear war. And during the Cold War, both the Russians and the Americans understood these unwritten rules of the game perfectly. So the key for the Russians right now in Syria is to, as fast as possible, strengthen the Syrians, particularly their air defenses. That is the single most important task. And they hinted pretty heavily at that during the press conference following the strikes. They actually said that we were asked by our allies not to provide S-300s to Syria. We will now reconsider that decision. Well, you know, S-300s, yes, they would be useful. They complement very nicely the Panzer system. But the key thing, I still think, is the Panzer. From the onset, I said, everybody focus on those very long-range systems. Don't. It's the anti-cruise missile system, the Panzer, which is the most important. And I think the Russians will be trying to bring as many of them as fast as possible in there, train the Syrians as fast as can be, and if that's not doable, then actually put some Syrian uniforms on Russian crews and deploy them, because that's what's going to decide militarily the next step in Syria.
Well, you've already begun to answer this, but what can you tell us about the new Russian weapons system? Vladimir Putin said that they have new weapons that are formidable.
Yes, but they have very little bearing on the conflict in Syria right now. Putin's key message really was that it was to basically officially announce the death of American anti-ballistic missile programs. The deployment of ABM capabilities in Europe, all this idea about putting capabilities in Alaska, etc. I mean, the message was is that mutual assured destruction, MAD, still holds in spite of your billions and trillions spent on bypassing it. Because what happened really was the U.S. wanted to protect themselves from a retaliatory counterstrike. So what Putin proved to the U.S. is, first, we can hit you. We can hit you conventionally, we can hit you anywhere in the United States, and you don't have the military capabilities to stop that. The second was sort of a subcomponent in one specific system to say your surface fleet worldwide is essentially attackable and there's nothing you can do about protecting your aircraft carriers. That's in the case of one specific weapon system he mentioned, the Kinjal. That does not directly impact the Middle Eastern theater of operations, at least not in the initial stages. It does if you escalate. Again, the nightmare scenario is that, say, Bolton prevails, and the next time around, Russians die, and Russians decide to, say, shoot back at either an American base in Syria, there are a couple of them, or a U.S. Navy ship, at which point the U.S. decides to seriously punish, as they would say, the Russian task force in Syria, which is too small to withstand a CENTCOM plus NATO attack. So the help to them would be coming from Russia proper in the form of, amongst other capabilities, one of these new systems. You could sort of see a recognition of that by the fact that American guided missile cruisers in the Mediterranean were not used during the latest strike. They hit from way further, the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea, which could be an indication that they were concerned that even if, as I think, they did indicate to the Russians what was happening, they still were afraid that, you know, you never know with these guys. So if we go for further escalation, these systems become relevant, the systems that Putin mentioned in his speech on, March 1st. But really, in terms of the Syrian conflict proper, it's not what he was speaking about.
You have written that Russia is the only country on the planet, with the possible exception of Iran, which openly and unapologetically dares to denounce the empire's hypocrisy and which is willing to back her words with military power if needed. Where is China in all of this?
Well, first of all, it was maybe a little unfair because there are countries. I want to mention Bolivia here. I had some commentators criticizing me for not mentioning the Bolivian stance in the UN Security Council, and that's a fair criticism. I was wrong about that. The Bolivians did denounce. Unfortunately, they're far away, and they don't have anywhere near the military capabilities to do anything other than protest. Now, Iran, Russia, and China have three completely different situations. Iran can back and has backed her position with military means, but in a local sense. That is, the U.S. cannot beat down Iran. The Iranians are on the ground in Syria. They have taken losses, severe losses, including generals. They have suffered. They lost way more people than the Russians did. So they're backing the rhetoric with actual military action, but what they can't do is reach far enough. They can locally reach within the Middle East, yes, but they cannot lob a missile in downtown Omaha. The Russians can. That's the bigger difference. Other than that, I would say the Iranians have been almost outside the forefront. They're at least as outspoken and courageous as the Russians are. I mean, I admire what they're doing tremendously. I think it's tremendous courage, and I just wish other countries, you know, could follow their example. China is really a different situation because their military used to be very, very antiquated. When I was studying the Chinese military compared to the two superpowers in the late 90s, we were always dismissing China as a huge military with 1950s capabilities. That's changing pretty fast. They're reducing in size. They're very rapidly improving capabilities. I think the Chinese have very real military capabilities. They could and already bring them to bear, no doubt in my mind. They're not on par with Russia, not even close, and many key technologies are far behind. But they already have reached, I would say, a threshold of military relevance. Let's put it this way, that they could take action. But their power is even different. Their economic power is immense, and their psychological political capital is huge. My big frustration is I don't want the Chinese to help the Russians militarily. I don't think they could do much. They have more of our capabilities in Asia, not in the Middle East. And the Russians really don't need that kind of help. But if psychologically China sided with Russia on a political level, on that first level we discussed of in the United Nations Security Council, and clearly indicated to the West that Russia and China are one, that would have a tremendous political impact on public opinion. And it is one thing to say we're going to take on the Bashar al-Assad regime and punish him for, you know, killing its own people with chemical weapons. A totally different language to say, okay, we're taking on the entire Eurasian continent. That's a much harder sell and would trigger much more objections, even from people who are generally unaware of the risk of what's happening now. Because the key thing is this. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, everybody was discussing the risks. The news media was freaking out, and justly. Now nobody does. It's just like business as usual. I mean, I'm based in Florida. I look at what's happening among adults here, or my daughter is in college, and my two sons are in college. Nobody talks about anything. They're unaware of it. We're at the edge of a nuclear war. Not a word is said. Well, if China moved in politically, that would raise much higher up the level of awareness in the West of what's taking place. Unfortunately, to my great regret, they're still taking a pretty lame, wishy-washy. I mean, they say very good things. They write good articles. Recently, there has been another one a couple of days ago. Chinese Minister of Defense said some very important and good things, which are basically noticed by U.S. analysts. But they already know that. The general public doesn't get to see it. And the U.N. Security Council, they repeat the usual pious statement about that we oppose any use of violence or threat of violence in violation of international law. Okay, that's good. But you still come across as pretty lame. That's not the kind of language that's going to get anybody's attention. That's what they could do, and that's what they're not doing. That's what I hope they will do if this thing escalates.
I'm speaking with author and military analyst, The Saker. Today's show, Superpower Confrontation in Syria. It's not over. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. How significant is the alliance between Turkey, Russia, and Iran?
Extremely. And that is part of the Anglo-Zionist problem, is that what Turkey, Russia, and Iran have in common is that they have real, meaningful military capabilities, i.e. boots on the ground in Syria. The Russians did something which the Americans thought would be absolutely impossible, which is they put, not only did they put together the good terrorists and the governments around a table for negotiations of the future of Syria, but they brought Iran and Turkey, which are not exactly friends, to jointly create a regional trilateral mechanism. And the real threat is, God forbid, peace would break out as a result of that, because these three countries have declared themselves guarantors of a peace process in Syria. That could lead to potentially catastrophic results for Israel. I mean, what it means is basically peace in Syria, some kind of new constitutional framework with local autonomy, no Kurdistans, Al-Qaeda types slashing throats and torturing people on TV, etc. It would actually be a normal, secular, pluralistic government backed by regional actors. Imagine the fury of the Saudis and the Israelis if that happens. And the point is, I think it is still most likely to happen. I don't think the Anglo-Zionists have the means to frustrate that anymore. So it's actually immensely relevant.
You write that, quote, there cannot be a one-world hegemon and a multipolar world order regulated by international law. It's an either-or situation. And in that sense, this is all much bigger than Syria or even Russia.
Yes, it's absolutely true. The U.S. project is very simple. We heard Mike Pompeo just say that we're exceptional and unique, I think was his word. And we heard, you remember Obama about the indispensable nation. Basically, what you have is an empire with a messianic ideology. I mean, there is a political consensus in the American political class, with a few exceptions on the fringes, but the vast majority agree on the following idea. The U.S. gets to rule the world in any way the hell they want. Period. Nothing else. No, nothing stands in the way of that. That is a project which is impossible to achieve. They don't realize that because, and it's always, I feel uncomfortable when I say that because it sounds like, you know, insults or invectives and not diagnosis. But I think they're illiterate, ignorant, and stupid. And they don't realize that this is a complete... It's a myth. They will never achieve that. The world is too complex, too big, and their power is declining so fast. So there is this tension between this messianic ideology of the one-world hegemon and the reality which is built every day today, which is a world which is multipolar. And by consensus, the countries creating that alternative do agree on the crucial principle, which is their different paths to development, and each one gets to choose his own. Sovereignty is crucial. You do not interfere in the internal affairs of a country, and relationship between those countries shall be ruled by international law. These are three principles which are absolutely, emphatically not acceptable to the Anglo-Zionists, and they consider them, and I would argue correctly so, as existential threat to their way of life. That is true. It is.
According to your analysis, then, one of the next moves of the Anglo-Zionist Empire could be on the Ukraine. Isn't that right?
That is the most likely, but I would not discount Syria either. It's not over there either. We're having at least two fronts. And a third one, which we shouldn't forget either, is Iran. We have, you know, bona fide nutcases like Bolton there and Trump himself, and they're all, you know, promising fire and brimstone against the Iranians and accusing them of God knows what. So we have at least three potential conflicts simmering already, ready to be unleashed at any time.
Yes. I guess if they were going to move against Iran, the next step would be to invalidate the nuclear treaty with Iran, don't you think?
Correct. Yes.
And then how would they go about doing that? Well, that has to be renewed periodically anyway, doesn't it?
Yep, but it would be extremely serious. Simply, the Iranians have already clearly indicated that if the Americans move out, they've threatened to basically say, well, okay, after that, our hands are freed. And they might even... No, there's some debate because there's an argument to be made that the correct Iranian response could be to ignore that, particularly if Europe sticks to its obligation. That is to say, the U.S. moved out, but UN, the Europeans stay in. And technically speaking, legally, only the U.N. Security Council could actually invalidate that agreement. So there could be a possibility for the Iranians to say, well, if the Europeans truly do not yield to American pressure, we won't do anything about it. But they've also said that we will have the sovereign right to decide to do whatever we want. At that point, it's so easy. After Skripal, after the false attacks, the chemical false flags, just say the Iranians are developing nuclear weapons again. You don't need any kind of proof. You just say it's highly likely. Step one, you say it's highly likely that the Iranians are developing nuclear weapons. And then all of the European chorus all together will go, we show solidarity. We show solidarity. And that's it. You've got all the ingredients to bomb Iran because they can't invade Iran. Same problem. They can't destroy a nuclear program that doesn't exist, but there's a lot of lucrative targets, civilian targets in Iran. You know, there are nuclear plants, civilian ones. There are research facilities. There's industrial capabilities. There is a huge list of lucrative targets which the Americans could hit inside Iran with the sole purpose of doing what Baker told to the Iraqis, bomb you back to the Stone Age. That would be the concept. Or what the Israelis did during the war against Lebanon. Basically, destroy as much of the civilian infrastructure, kill as many civilians as possible, destroy water, sanitation, electricity, destroy the civil society to make them pay for voting for the wrong people. That's what they did with Serbia. over Kosovo. So this is a time-tested and, you know, Anglo-Zionist method, which is if you can't get their military or their leadership, just go after the civilians and make them pay. If you want, it's like during the 19th century, you know, killing the Native Americans. Can't get their scouts in the forest, no problem. We'll just torch their villages. And that's basically the same concept, 21st century. That's what they would be going after.
How is it, in your opinion, that the Zionist lobby in the United States has so much power over foreign policy?
Well, here's the deal. I'm not sure that the Israel lobby in the United States is primarily concerned with Israel. I really think that we're dealing with a group of people who use Israel and the Zionist ideology as a tool to achieve power over the old Anglo-Saxon elite inside the United States. The U.S. has been an empire long before the Zionists became relevant here. Jews and Zionists are different things. There was always a pretty strong influence of Jews in the United States, and at key moments in history, that was clearly shown during the even as early as the Russian-Japanese War. U.S. banks played a key role in the Bolshevik Revolution, etc. But it still was primarily an Anglo or elite. And I think that elite has been gradually replaced by another one, which is not necessarily ethnically Jewish, but uses messianic ideology, a mix of Zionist Judaic ideology, and actually a uniquely American form of Protestant Christian, quote-unquote Christian, messianic ideology, you know, the city of the hill, indispensable nation, etc. They marry each other very nicely together, and they use basically two arguments. One is this entire Zionist issue. If you want to, if you allow me, I'll explain in a couple of words why this is so important, that term, because people always say, well, Zionism is just a national movement for Jews and the Jewish culture, and they have their own homeland. Look what happened to them in history and during World War II. Don't they deserve to have a place where they're safe? That idea, however, has a very disturbing assumption, which is that Jews are inherently threatened by all non-Jews worldwide. That's why the state of Israel is the state of all Jews. It's not the state of the Israelis. It's the state, officially by its own definition, is the state of all Jews on the planet. That's why a guy, you know, born in Brooklyn has more rights there than a guy born in downtown Jerusalem, if he's Palestinian. If once you accept that notion that Jews are threatened by non-Jews worldwide by some mysterious disease called anti-Semitism, which has no cause, no explanation, but can rear its head at any moment, you have to then take the measures to protect them, not only in Israel, but worldwide. Hence, you have the perfect tool to force the establishment of a specific world order. That's the catch. The catch is, it's a pretext. It's Israel Shahak said a wonderful thing. He said that Israeli policies are, you know, think locally and act globally. And that's really what's happening. That entire Zionist argument is a pretext. It's not really a concern for the well-being of the people of Israel, neither Jews nor Palestinians. It's a national tool to seize power inside the United States by using the tremendous resources and financial capabilities and political power of the Jewish community in the United States. And it's a worldwide tool to impose an order, because who besides the United States can guarantee that, you know, no anti-Semitic regime will ever rear its head up anywhere? Of course, the U.S. There you got it. You've got a rationalization for worldwide hegemony.
And worldwide hegemony for whom?
For what I think are not people who belong to a specific nationality. I think we're talking about here would almost be a Marxist and say a class consciousness. Basically, big money, big American money, or big actually even international money is probably the best way of saying it. There's no boardroom where the leaders of the hegemony or the empire meet and take, you know, decisions, and there's a list of these guys. It's much more of a ruling class. Like the Soviet Union had the nomenklatura, which was basically the real power behind the Central Committee and the KGB and the armed force. At the end of the day, it was this fairly large group of people. You have a similar construction in the Anglo-Zionist Empire. You have a mix of people with different ethnic backgrounds, quite a lot of them Jews, but by far not all. And the reverse is not true. It doesn't mean that most Jews actually endorse or even are aware of what's going on. And these people, they want world domination because basically they think that they're the best. It's exceptionalism. And that is something that exists very strongly in the Western culture for at least 1,000 years. We've seen that in many manifestations, ranging from the papacy to racist theories. It's Western exceptionalism married with Jewish exceptionalism as defended by rabbinical teachings in Pharisaic, rabbinical Judaism, and in the Zionist ideology, which is a secular war originally. These two things marry each other together very well, and they result in a people considering themselves superhumans, having the either God-given right or history-given right or the mission, Kipling's white man's burden, etc., to rule the planet. That's what's at the core of it.
Which brings us right back to what you wrote that I mentioned before. Quote, there cannot be a one-world hegemon in a multipolar world order regulated by international law. It's an either-or situation. So what you have just described is Zionism being used as part of this one-world hegemon.
What is needed is some justification for exceptionalism. It just happens that nowadays Zionism and the Israeli firsters and, the neocons happen to be, the thing of the day. But it's not inherently different from other forms of exceptionalism that the West, the papacy has had that kind of exceptionalism since the Middle Ages. I mean, they had a treaty called the Treaty of Tordesillas where they split, the Pope split the planet between the Portuguese and I think the Spanish, if I remember correctly, and said, we're going to split up the planet. And then you have European colonialism, and that's another form of exceptionalism. Again, Kipling with his white man's burden. And then we had the Nazis who were saying, we are racially, because, nationalism and racial theories were the thing of the 19th and then early 20th century. So they took that and said, again, it's all exceptionalism. It doesn't really matter what the ideology is. It is an ideology which says that there are some people that are more equal than others. That's the crucial thing. That's why we will not abide by international law. That's why we will not negotiate. That's why there's one set of rules for the poor and another set of rules for the big and mighty. All it is exceptionalism. The actual camouflage of the day of that exceptionalism really is not that crucial, I think.
Saker, thank you so much.
It is my pleasure, always.
I've been speaking with the Saker. Today's show has been Superpower Confrontation in Syria. It's not over. The Saker is an expert in military analysis, intelligence issues, Russian geopolitics, and traditional Christian orthodoxy. He was born in a military family of white Russian refugees in Western Europe, where he lived most of his life. He worked as a military analyst in Europe until he lost his career due to his vocal opposition to the Western-sponsored wars in Chechnya, Croatia, Bosnia, and Kosovo. He has been blogging since 2007 as the Saker. He is the author of The Essential Saker, From the Trenches of the Emerging Multipolar World, and his latest, The Essential Saker 2. Visit thesaker.is. That's the SAKER.is. IS stands for Iceland. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yarrow Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, we take a look back at the character of our time with part one of a stunning speech by Chris Hedges. I hope you'll stay tuned. Another year is over. Once again, I will spare you a review of the past year's top news stories. Everything this year was just too bizarre and depressing and intolerable for words. Among journalists, only the late Hunter S. Thompson could have done the year justice. Have you read Hunter S. Thompson? 1972 was a year almost as bad as 2014. Not in every way, but for sure in its politics. Thompson captured the spirit of that year brilliantly in his book Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail. He also wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, another fine work. Alas, he's not with us this year to write Fear and Loathing in the Belly of the Superpower. Hunter Thompson could have captured the essence of 2014 in words. I myself am drawing a blank, except for two words about the past year. Good riddance. I never cared for Bill Cosby anyway, let alone Dick Cheney. But I think we need some reflection on the character of our time, and for that we turn once again to journalist and essayist Chris Hedges. This summer, somebody posted a video of a Hedges speech on YouTube. There was no indication of the date or title of the original speech, but the video was named Chris Hedges' Greatest Speech Ever Made. I assume that the person who posted the video is young, because the title he gave it is entirely devoid of punctuation. Chris Hedges' Greatest Speech Ever Made. So I don't know if this is the greatest speech by anybody ever made, or just the greatest speech Chris Hedges ever made. Actually, it's neither, but it does strike me as a pretty good speech. Personally, I think the Sermon on the Mount was a better speech than this one, but I'll grant that this speech by Hedges is better than Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and much better than Richard Nixon's famous Checkers speech. Though I did like Nixon's line about Pat's good Republican cloth coat. But back to Hedges. Many people have assumed that this newly posted speech was made in 2014. But it seems to me that a more likely date is 2011. In the speech, Hedges refers to Bradley Manning, not Chelsea Manning. There's a reference to a recent royal wedding, and there's no mention of Occupy Wall Street. The speech is probably promoting Hedges' second book of 2010, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. But whatever the date of the speech, Hedges is also talking about today. Very little has changed. We just have 100 more examples we could add to the 50 examples Hedges gives. Examples of American freedom, democracy, and prosperity going to hell in a handbasket. We'll hear this talk this week and next. Robin Upton has nicely edited the talk for radio, and we will hear that edition. I'm going to give the speech a title myself, and that title is The Myth of Progress, The Necessity of Rebellion. Here is Chris Hedges.
I have walked through the barren remains of Babylon in Iraq, and the ancient Roman city of Antioch, the capital of Roman Syria, which now lies buried in silt deposits. I have visited the marble ruins of Leptis Magna, once one of the most important agricultural centers in the Roman Empire, and now isolated in the desolate drifts of sand southeast of Tripoli. I have climbed at dawn up the ancient temples in Tikal, while flocks of brightly colored toucans leapt through the jungle foliage below. I have stood amid the remains of the ancient Egyptian city of Luxor along the Nile, looking at the statue of the great Egyptian pharaoh Ramses II, lying broken on the ground, with Percy Shelley's poem Ozymandias running through my head. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare. The lone and level sands stretch far away. Civilizations rise, decay, and die. Time, as the ancient Greeks argued for individuals and for states, is cyclical. As societies become more complex, they become inevitably more precarious. They become increasingly vulnerable, burdened by vast bureaucracies, an increasingly rapacious and disconnected elite, and a blind loyalty to ideological systems and ideas that no longer correspond to reality. And as they begin to break down, there is a strange retreat by a frightened and confused population from reality, an inability to confront the fragility and impending collapse. The elites who speak in phrases and jargon that do not correspond to the real retreat into isolated compounds, whether at the court of Versailles, the Forbidden City, or our own enclaves of wealth and privilege. The elites indulge within these enclaves in unchecked hedonism, the accumulation of vaster wealth and extravagant consumption. They shut themselves off from the suffering of the masses who are repressed to extract wealth upwards with greater and greater ferocity. Resources are ruthlessly and thoughtlessly depleted until they are exhausted or destroyed. And then the hollowed-out edifice, which appeared unassailable and solid, collapses. The Roman and Sumerian empires fell this way. The Mayan elites, after cutting down their forests and polluting their streams with silt and acids, retreated like old dead empires back into primitivism. As food and water shortages expand across the globe, as mounting poverty and misery, including rising food costs, trigger street protests in the Middle East, Africa, and Europe, our elites are doing what all elites do. They launch more wars. They build grander monuments to themselves. They plunge their nations deeper into debt, and they take it out on the backs of the workers and the poor. The collapse of our global economy, which wiped out a staggering $40 trillion in wealth, was only the first jolt. Our elites, after destroying and dismantling our manufacturing base, sold massive quantities of fraudulent mortgage-backed securities to pension funds, small investors, banks, universities, state and foreign governments, and shareholders. And when the speculative game imploded, they looted the treasury, crying out that the nation had a deficit crisis. And of course it does not. It has a revenue crisis. And began dismantling basic social services, making war on the last vestiges of our unions, slashing jobs, freezing wages, throwing some 6 million Americans out of their homes, and standing idly by as we created a permanent underclass of unemployed and underemployed, which now sees 1 in 6 American workers without jobs. The Mayan elite became, at the end, the anthropologist Robert Wright notes in A Short History of Progress, extremists or ultra-conservatives squeezing the last drops of profit from nature and humanity. This is how all civilizations, including our own, ossify and die. The signs of imminent death may be, to those who can break free from our electronic hallucinations, undeniable. Common sense may cry out for a radical new response, but the race towards self-immolation only accelerates because of our intellectual and moral paralysis. As Sigmund Freud grasped, and beyond the pleasure principle and civilization and its discontents, human societies are as intoxicated and blinded by their own headlong rush toward death and destruction as they are by the search for erotic fulfillment. We live now in a nation where doctors destroy health, lawyers destroy justice, universities destroy knowledge, government destroys freedom, the press destroys information, religion destroys morals, and our banks destroy the economy. The turmoil in the Middle East, the implosion of national economies such as those of Ireland and Greece, the collapse of states such as Somalia and Ivory Coast, the increasing anger of a beleaguered working class at home and abroad, the growing, desperate human migrations, and the refusal to halt our relentless destruction of the ecosystem on which human life depends are the harbingers of our own collapse. They are the consequences of the idiocy of our elite and the folly of globalization. Protests and movements that are not built around a complete reconfiguration of American society, including a rapid dismantling of empire and the corporate state, can at best only forestall the inevitable. We will be saved only with the birth of a new and militant radicalism, one that defies all formal power structures, including the Democratic Party, which seeks to dethrone our corporate elite from power, not negotiate for better terms. Human societies seem cursed to repeat these cycles of exploitation and collapse. The greater the extent of the deterioration, the less these societies are able to comprehend what is happening to them. And the earth is littered with the physical remains of human folly, ignorance, and hubris. There is a dark intoxication with extinction, although this moment appears to be the denouement of the whole sad show of settled, civilized life that began some 5,000 years ago. For there is nothing left this time on the planet to seize, and we are now spending down the last remnants of our natural capital, including our forests, fossil fuel, air, and water. This time, when we go down, it will be global. There will be no new lands to pillage, no new peoples to conquer and exploit. Technology, which has obliterated the constraints of time and space, has turned our global village into a global death trap. The fate of Easter Island will be writ large across the broad expanse of planet Earth. The failure of the liberal class, whose role in society is designed to prevent unchecked assault by centralized power, is discovering what happens when you tolerate the intolerant. Let hate speech pollute your airwaves. Let corporations dry up your courts and state and federal legislative bodies. Let the Christian religion be manipulated by charlatans to demonize Muslims, gays, intellectuals, discredit science, sanctify unfettered capitalism, and become a source of personal enrichment. Let unions wither under corporate assault. Let social services and public education be gutted and stripped of funding. Let Wall Street carry out fraud, deception, and plunder with impunity, and you roll out the welcome mat for fascism. The liberal class and much of the left has busied itself with the toothless pursuits of inclusiveness, multiculturalism, identity politics, and tolerance, a word Martin Luther King never used, and forgot about the primacy of justice. It naively sought to placate ideological and corporate forces bent on the destruction of the democratic state as well as the planet. The liberal class, like the misguided Democrats in the former Yugoslavia or the hapless aristocrats in the Weimar Republic, invited the wolf into the henhouse. It forgot that, as Karl Popper wrote in The Open Society and Its Enemies, if we extend unlimited tolerance even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. Financial regulation, largely put in place by the New Deal, not only protected us from the worst excesses of capitalism, but were the bulwarks that made democratic participation possible. Workers in this country fought long and hard for their rights. They suffered brutal beatings, mass expulsions from company housing and jobs, endured crippling strikes, targeted assassinations of union leaders, and armed battles with hired gun thugs and state militias. The Rockefellers, the Mellons, the Carnegies, and the Morgans, the Koch brothers, Industries, Goldman Sachs, and Walmart of their day, never gave a damn about workers. All they cared about was profit. The 8-hour workday, the minimum wage, Social Security, pensions, job safety, paid vacations, retirement benefits, and health insurance were achieved because hundreds of thousands of workers physically fought a system of capitalist exploitation. They rallied around radicals such as Mother Jones, United Mine Workers President John L. Lewis, and Big Bill Haywood and his Wobblies, as well as the socialist presidential candidate Eugene V. Debs. They had no illusion that the bosses were their friends, much less celebrities, to be admired and emulated. It is they who made possible our middle class and opened up our democracy. The elite fought back viciously. Federal marshals, state militias, sheriff's deputies, and at times army troops, along with the courts and legislative bodies, were used to crush and stymie worker revolts. Striking sugarcane workers were gunned down in Louisiana in 1887. Steel workers were shot to death in 1892 in Homestead, Pennsylvania. Railroad workers in the Pullman strike of 1894 were murdered. Coal miners at Ludlow, Colorado, in 1914, and at Matwan, West Virginia, in 1920, were massacred. Our freedoms and rights were paid for with the blood of ordinary men and women. American democracy arose because those consciously locked out of the system put their bodies on the line and demanded justice. The exclusion of the poor and the working class from the systems of power in this country was, after all, deliberate. The Founding Fathers deeply feared popular democracy, and they rigged the system to protect the elite from the start, something that has been largely whitewashed in public schools and by a corporate media that has effectively substituted myth for history. Europe's poor, fleeing to America from squalid slums and workhouses in the 17th and 18th centuries, were viewed by the elite as commodities to exploit. Slaves, Native Americans, indentured servants, women, and men without property were not represented at the constitutional conventions. In American history, as Howard Zinn pointed out in The People's History of the United States, has been one long fight by the marginalized and the disenfranchised for dignity and freedom. Those who fought this battle understood the innate cruelty of capitalism. When you sell your product, you retain your person, said a tract published in the 1880s during the Lowell, Massachusetts mill strikes. But when you sell your labor, you sell yourself, losing the rights of free men and becoming vassals of mammoth establishments of a moneyed aristocracy that threatens annihilation to anyone who questions their right to enslave and oppress. Those who work in the mills ought to own them, not have the status of machines ruled by private despots who are entrenching monarchic principles on democratic soil as they drive downwards freedom and rights, civilization, health, morals, and intellectuality in the new commercial feudalism. As Noam Chomsky points out, the sentiment expressed by the Lowell mill workers predated Marxism. It points to a time in American history 150 years ago when working for wages was a form of chattel slavery. The slogan of the Republican Party, the banner under which Northern workers went to fight in the Civil War, was, "We're against chattel slavery and wage slavery. Free people did not rent themselves to others. Freedom means not taking orders from others." It took a long time, Chomsky points out, to drive into people's heads the idea that it is legitimate to rent yourself. And once that was accomplished, we began to internalize oppression. We chatter about something called the American dream. And now that the oligarchic elite have regained control of all of the levers of power, that dream is being exposed as a cruel hoax. And we are being shoved back into the cage. Slick public relations campaigns, the collapse of public education, nearly a third of the country is illiterate or semi-literate, the rise of amoral politicians such as Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, who pose as liberals while selling their souls and betraying basic liberal and democratic principles for corporate money, have left us largely defenseless. The last vestiges of unionized workers in the public sector are reduced to protesting in states like Wisconsin for collective bargaining, in short, the right to ask employers for fair working conditions. This shows how far labor and the country has deteriorated, and it looks as though even this basic right to ask, as well as raise money through union dues, has at least for the moment been successfully revoked in Madison. The Democratic Party and the remnants of organized labor steered passions in Wisconsin away from a general strike where workers should have gone to tepid attempts to recall legislators. The public debate, meanwhile, dominated by corporate control systems of information, ignores the steady impoverishment of the working class and absence of legal and regulatory mechanisms to prevent our reconfiguration into a neo-feudal society. The airwaves are saturated with good-looking and charming corporate apologists. They ask us why public sector employees have benefits sneeringly called entitlements, while non-unionized working and middle-class people are denied. And the argument is ingenious. It pits desperate worker against desperate worker in a mad scramble for scraps. It is, of course, the wrong question. Why, we should ask, don't working men and women have health insurance, pension plans, job protection, and living wages? And until we again speak in the language of open class warfare, grasping, as those who went before us did, that the elite will always promote itself at our expense, we are doomed to a 21st serfdom. The pillars of the liberal establishment, which once made incremental and piecemeal reform possible, no longer function. The liberal church, for example, forgot that Christian heretics exist. It forgot that the scum of society, look at the new Newt Gingrich, always wrap themselves in the flag and clutch the Christian cross to promote programs that mock the core teachings of Jesus Christ. And for all their years of seminary training and Bible study, these liberal clergy have stood by mutely as tele-evangelists betrayed and exploited the gospel to promote bigotry, hatred, and greed. What was the point, I wonder, of ordination? Did they think the radical message of the gospel was something they would never have to fight for? Schools and universities on their knees for corporate dollars and their boards dominated by hedge fund managers and investment bankers. have deformed education into the acquisition of narrow vocational skills that serve specialized corporate interests. Our public schools create classes of drone-like systems managers. They make little attempt to equip students to make moral choices, stand up for civic virtues, to seek a life of meaning, and to actually think. The moral and ethical issues that should define education are no longer asked. Humanities departments, whose liberal arts curriculum once challenged structures and assumptions, are vanishing as swiftly as the ocean's fish stocks. The electronic and much of the print press has become a shameless mouthpiece for the powerful, a vehicle for spectacle and a magnet for corporate advertising. As anyone watching the live coverage of the royal wedding, sponsored by J.P. Morgan Chase, grasped. It does not give a platform to the poor, to working men and women, but diverts us with celebrity meltdowns, lavish lifestyle programs, reality television, and gossip. Artists who once had something to say have retreated into elite enclaves, preoccupied themselves with abstract, self-referential junk and the frivolous. Advertising agencies and publicists flood the airwaves with lies on behalf of corporate sponsors, and the Democratic Party, most egregiously, sold out working men and women for corporate money. It permitted, under Clinton and Obama, the state apparatus to be surrendered to corporate interests. And there is no liberal institution left. The press, labor, culture, public education, the church, or the Democratic Party that makes any effort to hold back the corporate juggernaut. And the longer we are tricked into investing our faith in the power system, the more easily we will be exploited. We have been taught to tolerate the intolerant, from propaganda outlets such as Fox News to Christian fascists to lunatics and bigots in the Republican Party, to a criminal class on Wall Street and in corporations, and we are paying the price. The only place left for us is on the street.
Chris Hedges, with a shrewd argument that our society has not been progressing. In fact, it's been regressing. While the rich and powerful have been getting richer and more powerful, the 99% have been moving further away from liberty, fraternity, equality, prosperity, and democracy. Please come back again next week for the second half of this talk. You've been listening to New World Notes. Our website is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thanks again to Robin Upton of unwelcomeguests.net. for the lightly edited audio. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening. You'll get to my non-carborundum and keep up the good fight. Ciao. Thank you.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
If you listen to the alternative public affairs programs on this station regularly, you probably get just how controlled, complicit, corrupt, and compromised the corporate and some, quote, alternative media are. But the three speeches you'll hear on today's show will probably still shock you a little and take you a little deeper into just how controlled and fraudulent much of our information sources are. All of what you're about to hear has been lightly edited to fit within our time constraints. The first speaker is Udo Urfkat, a former German journalist and former editor of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. In 2014, he came out with the book Bought Journalism, How Politicians, Intelligence, and High Finance Control Germans' Mass Media. And here he is, Udo Urfkat. And this is from an interview he did on Russia Today.
I've been a journalist for about 25 years. And I was educated to lie, to betray, and not to tell the truth to the public. But seeing right now, within the last months, how the German and American media tries to bring war to the people in Europe, to bring war to Russia, this is a point of no return. And I am going to stand up and say it is not right what I have done in the past, to manipulate people, to make propaganda against Russia. And it is not right what my colleagues do and have done in the past, because they are bribed to betray the people, not only in Germany, all over Europe. The reason writing this book was that I am very fearful of a new war in Europe, and I don't like to have this situation again, because war is never coming from itself. There is always people behind it to push for war. And this is not only politicians, this is journalists too. And I just have written in the book how we have betrayed in the past our readers just to push for war, because I don't want this anymore. I'm fed up with this propaganda. We live in a banana republic and not in a democratic country where we have press freedom, where we have human rights. If you see the German media, especially my colleagues who day by day write against the Russians, who are in transatlantic organizations and who are supported by the United States to do so, well, people like me, I became honorary citizen of the state of Oklahoma in the United States just because I wrote pro-American. I was supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, by the CIA. Why? Because I should be pro-American. I'm fed up with it. I don't want to do it anymore. So I've just written a book not to earn money. No, it will cause a lot of trouble for me, just to give the people in this country, in Germany, in Europe, and all over the world, just to give them a glimpse of a view what goes up behind the closed doors. There is many examples for that. If we go just back to history, if you go into the year 1988, if you go to your archives, you will find in March 1988 that there was in Iraq, the Kurdish people have been gassed with poisoned gas. That is known all over the world. But in July 1988, they sent me to a town called Zubaydat, that is on the Iraqi-Iranian border. It was war between the Iranians and the Iraqis, and I was sent there to photograph how the Iranians have been gassed with poisoned gas, with German poisoned gas. You call it Lost and Zarin, mustard gas, made by Germany. They have been gassed, and I was there to make photographs how these people have been killed by poison gas from Germany. When I came back to Germany, there was just one small photo in a newspaper, in the Frankfurter Allgemeine, and there was one small article, not writing how impressive, brutally, how unhuman, how terrible it was to kill, decades after the end of the Second World War, people with German poisoned gas. So this was a situation I feel misused for having been there and just to give a documentary what has been done, but not being allowed to cry out to the world what we have done behind closed doors. Up to today, it's not well known in the public that with German public gas, there have been hundreds or thousands of people gassed in this city of Zubeda. Now, you ask, what have I done for intelligence agencies? So please see, most of the journalists you see in foreign countries, they claim to be journalists, and they might be journalists, European or American journalists, but many of them, like me in the past, are so-called non-official cover. That's what the Americans call that. I have been a non-official cover. Non-official cover means what? It means you too work for an intelligence agency. You help them if they want you to help them, but they will never, never, when they find out that you are not only a journalist, but a spy too, they will never say, oh, this was one of our guys. They will not know you. That means non-official cover. So I have helped them in several situations, and I feel ashamed for that too now. Like I feel ashamed that I have worked for a very recommended newspaper like the Frankfurter Allgemeine, because I was bribed by billionaires, I was bribed by the Americans not to report exactly the truth. But I just imagined in my car while I was driving to this interview, I just tried to work out in my brain what would have happened if I would have written a pro-Russian article in the Frankfurter Allgemeine. Well, I don't know what would have happened, but we were all educated to write pro-European, pro-American, but please, not pro-Russian. So I'm very sorry for that, but this is not what I understand for democracy and for press freedom. I'm very sorry for that. Germany is still a kind of a colony of the United States. You see that in many points, like the majority of the Germans don't want to have nukes in our country, but we still have American nukes. So we are still a kind of a colony of the Americans. And being a colony, it is very easy to approach young journalists through what is very important here is transatlantic organizations. All journalists from really respected and recommended big German newspapers, magazines, radio stations, TV stations, they are all members or guests of those big transatlantic organizations. And in these transatlantic organizations, you are approached to be pro-American. And there is nobody coming to you and saying, well, we are the Central Intelligence Agency. Would you like to work for us? No, this is not the case how it happens. What they do, these transatlantic organizations, is they invite you for seeing the United States. They pay for that. They pay all your expenses and everything. So you are bribed. You get more and more corrupt because they make you good contacts. You won't know that those good contacts are, let's say, non-official covers or officially people working for Central Intelligence Agency or other American agencies. So you make friends. You think they are friends and you cooperate with them. But they ask you, well, could you do me this favor? Could you do me that favor? And so your brain more and more is brainwashed through these guys. And is this only the case with German journalists? No, I think it is especially the case with British journalists, because they have a much closer relationship. It is especially the case with Israelis, of course, with French journalists far apart, not that big as with German or with British journalists. It is the case for Australian journalists, for journalists from New Zealand, from Taiwan, from, well, there is many countries in the Arab world, like Jordan, for example, like Oman, the Sultanate of Oman. There is many countries where this happens, where you find people to claim they are respected journalists, but if you look behind them, you'll find they are puppets on a string of the Central Intelligence Agency. Sometimes the intelligence agencies, they come to your office and want you to write an article. I give you an example, not from strange other journalists, from me myself. I've just forgotten the year. I just remember that the German Foreign Intelligence, Bundesnachrichtendienst, it is just a sister organization of the Central Intelligence Agency. It was founded by the American Intelligence Agency. So one day, the BND, this German Foreign Intelligence Agency, came to my office at the Frankfurter Allgemeine in Frankfurt. And they wanted me to write an article about Libya and about Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. I had absolutely no secret informations regarding Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and Libya. But they gave me all these secret informations and they just wanted me to sign the article with my name. I did that, but it was an article that was published in the Frankfurt Allgemeine that originally came from the Bundesnachrichtendienst, from the German Foreign Intelligence Agency. So do you really think that this is journalism? Intelligence agencies writing articles? That article was how Libya and Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, how he secretly tried to build a poison gas factory, I think in Rabta was the name, yeah. It was a story that was printed worldwide 2 days later. But I had no information on that. It was the intelligence agency that wanted me to write this article. So, but this is not the way journalism should work, that intelligence agencies, that they decide what is printed and what not. If I say no, I give you a very good example if you say no. Well, we have a rescue unit in Germany with helicopters for traffic accidents. They call themselves the Yellow Angels. There was one guy who didn't want to cooperate. He was a pilot of the helicopter service of the Yellow Angels in Germany. This guy said no to the Foreign Intelligence Service, Bundesnachrichtendienst, when they approached him and wanted him as a non-official cover to work for the German Foreign Intelligence Agency, just to pretend to be somebody from the Yellow Angels. So what happened was that he lost his job. And the court in Germany, the judge decided that they were right because such a guy could not be trusted. He was kicked off his job because he didn't cooperate with the Foreign Intelligence Service. So I knew what would happen if I would not cooperate with intelligence services. I have had 6 times my house was house searched because I was accused by the public prosecutor, the German public prosecutor. I was accused of leaking secrets of states. 6 times house searched. Well, they hoped that I wouldn't do that ever again. But I think it's worse that the truth will come out one day. The truth won't die. And I don't mind what will happen. I've had 3 heart attacks. I have no children. So if they want to bring me to court or to prison, so it's worse for the truth.
And sadly, Udo Ulfkat passed away recently. Next, you're going to hear former CBS News correspondent Cheryl Adkinson. She resigned from CBS in March of 2014 after 21 years. She's received many awards. One was an Emmy Award for Outstanding Investigative Journalism for her reporting on the business of Congress. And here she is giving a TED Talk called AstroTurf and Manipulation of Media Messages. And this was first published on YouTube in February of 2015.
So, consider this fictitious example that's inspired by real life. Say you're watching the news and you see a story about a new study on the cholesterol-lowering drug called Cholextra. The study says Cholextra is so effective that doctors should consider prescribing it to adults and even children who don't yet have high cholesterol. Is it too good to be true? You're smart. You decide to do some of your own research. You do a Google search. You consult social media, Facebook and Twitter. You look at Wikipedia, WebMD, a nonprofit website, and you read the original study in a peer-reviewed published medical journal. It all confirms how effective Cholextra is. You do run across a few negative comments and a potential link to cancer, but you dismiss that because medical experts call the cancer link a myth and say that those who think there is a link there are quacks and cranks and nuts. Finally, you learn that your own doctor recently attended a medical seminar. The lecture that he attended confirmed how effective Cholextra is, so he sends you off with some free samples and a prescription. You've really done your homework. But what if all isn't as it seems? What if the reality you found was false? a carefully constructed narrative by unseen special interests designed to manipulate your opinion. A Truman Show-esque alternate reality all around you. Complacency in the news media combined with incredibly powerful propaganda and publicity forces mean we sometimes get little of the truth. Special interests have unlimited time and money to figure out new ways to spin us while cloaking their role. Surreptitious astroturf methods are now more important to these interests than traditional lobbying of Congress. There's an entire industry built around it in Washington. What is astroturf? It's a perversion of grassroots, as in fake grassroots. AstroTurf is when political, corporate, or other special interests disguise themselves and publish blogs, start Facebook and Twitter accounts, publish ads, letters to the editor, or simply post comments online to try to fool you into thinking an independent or grassroots movement is speaking. The whole point of AstroTurf is to try to give the impression there's widespread support for or against an agenda when there's not. AstroTurf seeks to manipulate you into changing your opinion by making you feel as if you're an outlier when you're not. One example is the Washington Redskins name. Without taking a position on the controversy, if you simply were looking at news media coverage over the course of the past year or looking at social media, you'd probably have to conclude that most Americans find that name offensive and think it ought to be changed. But what if I told you 71% of Americans say the name should not be changed? That's more than two-thirds. AstroTurfers seek to controversialize those who disagree with them. They attack news organizations that publish stories they don't like, whistleblowers who tell the truth, politicians who dare to ask the tough questions, and journalists who have the audacity to report on all of it. Sometimes AstroTurfers simply shove intentionally so much confusing and conflicting information into the mix that you're left to throw up your hands and disregard all of it, including the truth. Drown out a link between a medicine and a harmful side effect, say vaccines and autism, by throwing a bunch of conflicting paid-for studies, surveys, and experts into the mix, confusing the truth beyond recognition. And then there's Wikipedia, AstroTurf's dream come true. Billed as the free encyclopedia that anyone can edit, the reality can't be more different. Anonymous Wikipedia editors control and co-opt pages on behalf of special interests. They forbid and reverse edits that go against their agenda. They skew and delete information in blatant violation of Wikipedia's own established policies with impunity, always superior to the poor schlubs who actually believe anyone can edit Wikipedia, only to discover they're barred from correcting even the simplest factual inaccuracies. Try adding a footnoted fact or correcting a fact error on one of these monitored Wikipedia pages and poof, sometimes within a matter of seconds, you'll find your edit is reversed. In 2012, famed author Philip Roth tried to correct a major fact error about the inspiration behind one of his book characters cited on a Wikipedia page. But no matter how hard he tried, Wikipedia's editors wouldn't allow it. They kept reverting the edits back to the false information. When Roth finally reached a person at Wikipedia, which was no easy task, and tried to find out what was going wrong, they told him he simply was not considered a credible source on himself. A few weeks later, there was a huge scandal when Wikipedia officials got caught offering a PR service that skewed and edited information on behalf of paid, publicity-seeking clients in utter opposition to Wikipedia's supposed policies. All of this may be why, when a medical study looked at medical conditions described on Wikipedia pages and compared it to actual peer-reviewed published research, Wikipedia contradicted medical research 90% of the time. You may never fully trust what you read on Wikipedia again, nor should you. Let's now go back to that fictitious Kalextra example and all the research you did. It turns out the Facebook and Twitter accounts you found that were so positive were actually written by paid professionals hired by the drug company to promote the drug. The Wikipedia page had been monitored by an agenda editor also paid by the drug company. The drug company also arranged to optimize Google search engine results, so it was no accident that you stumbled across that positive nonprofit that had all those positive comments. The nonprofit was, of course, secretly founded and funded by the drug company. The drug company also financed that positive study and used its power of editorial control to omit any mention of cancer as a possible side effect. Once more, each and every doctor who publicly touted Kalextra or called the cancer link a myth or ridiculed critics as paranoid cranks and quacks or served on the government advisory board that approved the drug, each of those doctors is actually a paid consultant for the drug company. As for your own doctor, the medical lecture he attended that had all those positive evaluations was, in fact, like many continuing medical education classes, sponsored by the drug company. And when the news reported on that positive study, it didn't mention any of that. I have tons of personal examples from real life. A couple of years ago, CBS News asked me to look into a story about a study coming out from the nonprofit National Sleep Foundation. Supposedly, this press release coming out said, "The study concluded we are a nation with an epidemic of sleeplessness and we don't even know it, and we should all go ask our doctors about it." A couple of things struck me about that. First, I recognized the phrase, "ask your doctor," as a catchphrase promoted by the pharmaceutical industry. They know that if they can get your foot through the door of the doctor's office to mention a malady, you're very likely to be prescribed the latest drug that's marketed. Second, I wondered how serious an epidemic of sleeplessness could really be if we don't even know that we have it. Right? It didn't take long for me to do a little research and discover that the National Sleep Foundation nonprofit and the study, which was actually a survey, not a study, were sponsored in part by a new drug that was about to be launched onto the market called Lunesta, a sleeping pill. I reported the study as CBS News asked, but of course I disclosed the sponsorship behind the nonprofit and the survey so that viewers could weigh the information accordingly. All the other news media reported the same survey directly off the press release as written without digging past the superficial. It later became an example written up in the Columbia Journalism Review, which quite accurately reported that only we at CBS News had bothered to do a little bit of research and disclose the conflict of interest behind this widely reported survey. So now you may be thinking, what can I do? I thought I'd done my research. What chance do I have separating fact from fiction, especially if seasoned journalists with years of experience can be so easily fooled? Well, I have a few strategies that I can tell you about to help you recognize signs of propaganda and astroturf. Once you start to know what to look for, you'll begin to recognize it everywhere. First, hallmarks of astroturf include use of inflammatory language such as crank, quack, nutty, lies, paranoid, pseudo, and conspiracy. Astroturfers often claim to debunk myths that aren't myths at all. Use of the charged language tests well. People hear something's a myth, maybe they find it on Snopes, and they instantly declare themselves too smart to fall for it. But what if the whole notion of the myth is itself a myth and you and Snopes fell for that? Beware when interests attack an issue by controversializing or attacking the people, personalities, and organizations surrounding it rather than addressing the facts. That could be astroturf. And most of all, astroturfers tend to reserve all of their public skepticism for those exposing wrongdoing rather than the wrongdoers. In other words, instead of questioning authority, they question those who question authority. You might start to see things a little more clearly. It's kind of like taking off your glasses and wiping them and putting them back on and realizing for the first time how foggy they'd been all along. I can't resolve these issues, but I hope that I've given you some information that will at least motivate you to take off your glasses and wipe them and become a wiser consumer of information in an increasingly artificial, paid-for reality. Thank you.
And now we'll hear from the third speaker, three-time Emmy Award-winning journalist Amber Lyon, who worked for CNN. And this is from a 2013 interview on RT America, where Amber reveals CNN lies and war propaganda. And here she is.
Well, I really worry here that the United States public is being led into another potential conflict with Iran, the similar way that we were led into the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, because you're starting to see the mainstream media really overhype the situation in Iran and omit important facts. And if you look at all the propaganda being fed to the American public right now in terms of Iran, we have movies here coming out, Argo. We've got the mainstream media oversaturation of coverage of the Iran situation. And based on everything that's happening here in the U.S. with the mortgage crisis, the economy, the fact that most Americans are having problems just getting by day to day, the fact that the mainstream media is overcovering Iran only says one thing to me, and that's that the American public is being propagated into another war. And this is something that goes back to the terms weapons of mass destruction. The American public was fed that phrase over and over and over leading into the Iraq war. And now we're starting to see it as far as nuclear weapons and Iran goes in the U.S. And I just fear that the public is continuing to be fed propaganda that unassuming Americans don't realize they're being fed to lead us into another potential conflict. I really can't speculate as to exactly why this is going on, but I can tell you that when I was working for CNN, we did have a documentary that we aired on the Bahrain situation, and that's where we have our naval base, which is right across from Iran, so we strategically want to keep that naval base, and it was very difficult to get stories on about Bahrain. I even came out a couple weeks ago talking about the censorship of that documentary on CNN International. And above all, I feel that the American public is not being fed the true story about what's going on in this region. And it's very dangerous because when the public is constantly fed messages that are potentially leading us into a war that may not be necessary, it's not fair to the American people and it's not fair to journalism because the truth isn't being told here. What's being told here is the way that these networks want to spin the truth. And that's leading us into another potential conflict with Iran. And I've been trying to tell my followers on my Facebook page and on Twitter to really open your eyes, because once you notice, you take the blindfold off, you start to see all of this anti-Iran propaganda floating through the American mainstream media. And it's symbolic of exactly what was going on before the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I still haven't been given an exact reason as to why it didn't air. I went and visited with the president of CNN International, Tony Maddox, twice on behalf of my dumbfounded crew, and we were never given an answer. And so I started investigating the situations after several employees who'd been at the network for years approached me and said, you need to look into this. There's something going on. It's very strange they're not airing your documentary. And after some investigation, we found out that CNN International is actually making money from the Bahrain regime. They are a customer of Bahrain. Bahrain is paying CNN International to create content that shows Bahrain in a favorable light. Also, not only to create that content, to then air that content on CNN International. In one of the shows, it was called I List Bahrain. It was back in 2010. It was sponsored by Bahrain. And Richard Quest was live from the country for a week talking about the Formula One race and how progressive Bahrain was and how the Crown Prince was a reformer. Well, we saw in February 2011 that under the Crown Prince's rule, the military troops shot and killed unarmed protesters in broad daylight. And this is very dangerous because what CNN is doing, and they're not only taking money from just Bahrain, they've also produced similar content for Georgia, Kazakhstan, and other nations as well, Lebanon. And what makes this dangerous is they're not disclosing to the viewers that these sponsored programs are actually being sponsored. Or if they are disclosing it, it's in very small gray lettering at the bottom of the article. And that's dangerous not only to our foreign policy, but once again, making the American public and the public in general that's watching this network think that there are rosy situations happening in these countries when that's not the case, as we've seen with Bahrain. And it's defrauding viewers and it's defrauding their own journalists. I was not told as a journalist working at the network that this was going on. It wasn't clearly disclosed to me that at the same time I was investigating the Bahrain regime, Bahrain was a paying customer at CNN. They never told us why they weren't playing it, even though I asked the head of CNN International twice about it. And even bosses above me told me they didn't have answers for me and I'd have to go searching for those answers. So that pretty much, as an investigative reporter, tells me that something's going on. So on behalf of my crew, I got to get to the bottom of things. We had fixers and drivers in Bahrain who are currently now have been laid off because they helped us film that documentary. Some who are continually still harassed. Doctors Without Borders employee who actually drove us into these villages to show us doctors who'd been beaten by security forces. He risked his safety. Several months after our documentary, his home was burnt down. And in part, activists say because he helped CNN with that documentary. These sources, these people on the ground did not know that at the same time CNN was taking money from this regime to make rosy content that would negate their content. And they risked their lives. And I feel like CNN owes them an apology as well as an apology to viewers and its own journalists for defrauding them with this information.
So there you have it. Three journalists telling us how the controlled, complicit, corrupt, and compromised corporate and sometimes, quote, alternative media really work. Based on these revelations, is it any wonder that we don't hear about the mountains of censored evidence that proves the official account of 9/11 to be totally fraudulent? Perhaps we could learn from Bahrain and buy our way onto these corrupt media outlets. But one thing we can surely do to exercise our people power is to just turn them off. And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nair.
The Coalition for an International Offensive to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal and all political prisoners is gaining momentum.
With Solidarity Action's plan for the court hearing on April 30th, which could eventually lead to his freedom.
After years of global community meetings, protests, petitions, and legal challenges, the People's Movement succeeded in taking Mumia off death row. Mumia now has become a name recognized such that it rivals top-tier athletes and entertainers and is considered a hero to all people seeking liberation, having inspired millions around the world who rally regularly on his behalf, demanding he receives release now or a new trial.
And in France, Mumia is considered a freedom fighter because of his advocacy for the oppressed everywhere. Mumia is the voice of the voiceless, who chronicles the legacy of people's struggles worldwide. And one of the greatest threats to U.S. imperialism is the uprising of young Mumias from the streets of Philadelphia to the streets of Paris.
Mumia has wrongly spent more than half his life in prison, most of which time was on death row and in solitary confinement, before the Supreme Court held that application of the death penalty to Mumia was unconstitutional and instead shackled him with a life sentence for a crime, the killing of a police officer, that he did not commit. We are honored to have in studio Jackie Otto, a union organizer and member of the General Confederation of Labor in France, the CGT, a national trade union center, the first of the five major French confederations of trade unions. He is co-chair of Liberons Mumia, and Patrick Kamenik, a retired journalist, who remains active in the union movement in the SNJ, part of the CGT, and with the National Union of Journalists, CGT. He is a representative of the European Federation of Journalists. And Dr. Claude Guillemot-Pujol, professor of American Studies in Tours and Clermont-Ferrand Universities, and author of a book about women in prison dedicated to the MOVE sisters. And in 2007, wrote the Abu-Jamal biography, A Free Man on Death Row. Our guest, at least two of them. One of our guests was not allowed in to see Mumia. The other two were. I want you to tell me what you can about that visit.
I'll speak first, and after I think Jackie could say words too. I've been visiting Mumia since 1995, so I've been a regular visitor on death row. Jackie joined me later in 2000. Once you step into death row, you just can't leave them behind. You've got to go on and keep visiting them. It's very disturbing for the guards to see that these people which we think are just nobody, with death row prisoners, which we treat horribly, can have visitors, especially visitors from abroad. Seeing Mumia, the first time you see in this glass cabinet and you can touch him, and he's very charismatic, very proud, very bright, something you can never forget. You see such a person caged, you see our democracies have a big problems.
J'ai rencontré donc avec Claude un grand nombre de fois Mumia Abou-Jamal.
I met Mumia many times with Claude.
D'abord dans le couloir de la mort. Puis, lorsque sa peine a été commuée, dans la prison où il se trouve actuellement à Frackville.
For a couple of times on death row and now in Frackville. What Jackie could add is that we were with Mumia the day the decision was taken about commuting his sentence to life in prison. We didn't know how that was going to happen.
Ce que je retiens de toutes ces visites, c'est que ce soit aujourd'hui ou lors des fois précédentes, depuis donc de très nombreuses fois, je suis toujours impressionné par l'homme qu'est Mumia.
Whether it was on death row or nowadays, is that I'm always very impressed by the man Mumia Abou-Jamal.
Par son parcours de journaliste.
First because I've been a journalist.
Par son charisme.
So charismatic.
Par la communication, comme il est capable de transmettre lorsqu'on le rencontre même la première fois. On a l'impression de le connaître déjà depuis très longtemps.
It was impressive, but even if the first time you meet him, you think you have known him forever.
Et surtout par la force incroyable, il a un charisme physique aussi, mais la force incroyable de sa voix, de sa conviction et du combat qu'il mène en prison depuis tant d'années.
Because he's such a special voice, and because he's such a committed man, and because of the strength of his character, and how he can keep on fighting after all these years on death row and in prison today.
Et ce combat, en toute modestie, comme il nous le dit toujours, ou des fois il ne le dit pas, mais on le ressent, c'est le combat qu'il mène finalement pour tous les autres, tous ceux qui sont victimes d'incroyables injustices, comme c'est son cas.
Even if he doesn't say it, you know, he's not fighting just for himself. He's fighting for everybody. That's what's very incredible.
But you are labor activists. You are trade union activists, and you're here from France. And I'm sure many people are saying, why should people in France have such affection for our political prisoner? What does it mean for the French people? And where does this tie in to being labor activists in France?
Question I've been asked to me again and again in Philadelphia by the journalists from the Inquirer, of course. Okay, what are you doing here? Don't you have French prisoners? And I've been repeating again and again, so I'm not interfering with your country, not at all. But that's kind of French history, European history. We always stood for Angela Davis. We stood for Mandela. We stood for all political prisoners anymore. And that's part of a history. Fighting for someone who has been oppressed is just fighting for all of us out of solidarity. That's it.
But you have street signs with Mumia. You have, I think, towns named after Mumia. It's really something exceptional that we need to learn from you. What is it about Mumia and France that really clicks?
I don't have an explanation. Sometimes I can see something very shocking. I say, Mumia, it's a lucky story. I think we bump into each other. We bump into city councillor. We felt concerned by the case. He's been made honorary citizen in something like 20 cities. Yes, he's got two streets named after him. I think he's a popular hero. He's got this big smiley face. He never complains. He writes beautiful books. Life from Death Row, I just always say, it's just like the diary of Anne Frank for Jewish girl, you know. Mm. It's something which, if I say ordinary, it would be derogative, but that's something that's everyday life. It's a kind of love story. Jack is excellent also. He's a good organizer and fundraiser, you know. And we get donation. We've been doing a lot of money for Mumia campaign from very people with small revenue. We get $10, $20. And finally, that's a lot of money. That's the way you build love and solidarity.
Patrick?
As a journalist, I must say, he's part of our fight because he's one of ours, even if he's an American, whatever nation. He's an ordinary member of our union. Therefore, I was so disappointed, so sad I couldn't visit him and translate for him all we've done for him and all the message we have received to support him. And the last thing we did, it's important, the International Federation of Journalists send a letter to the governor of Pennsylvania to ask about the health of Mumia, to ask them to help Mumia for curing and giving it back to a normal situation. Therefore, I think the fight is altogether a simple worker, journalist, because we are fighting for freedom of expression. The journalist who is beyond bars, we cannot leave that without fighting. And the same fight we have with our colleagues in Turkey. 150 colleagues are beyond bars in Turkey. We are doing the same fight. But Mumia is a kind of a brother. It's nearly 30 years we are fighting with Jackie, with Claude, to free Mumia. And we will not let that down, even if I couldn't visit him in the jail. We will, of course, do as much as we can to help him with the new trial, with the possibility that Mumia will be someday in Paris.
Why couldn't you get in to visit him in the jail?
I didn't receive any official explanation. They just say you are not on the list. I suppose because maybe my former job prevent me to...
Your former job, which is journalist. Well, that's a good reason.
If I may say something, his brother Keith couldn't visit him yesterday. Mumia's brother was very sick. We came from North Carolina, and they turned him down. They said, you can't get in. He was very, very upset. And the reason was that Mumia already had visitors on Saturday, and visitors were us, because Kyiv said, I'm coming from far away. And the guards said, yes, but French people come from further still. And they came on Saturday, so you can't get in, which is totally stupid. He should have been allowed in.
Well,
it's extremely cruel.
Part of the sadism, we're talking about a man who's been on death row, a man who's been in solitary for most of that, and who has been denied health care, and to this day is being denied the kind of health care he needs to live a comfortable life. But I see, Jackie, your story about what you think politically Mumia has meant and why it relates to the struggles indeed in France.
Pour répondre à votre question, je suis un militant syndical et très jeune, engagé. Je me suis, j'allais dire, j'ai appris dans mon travail de syndicaliste.
Age, I learned that all fights are connected and you have to be in solidarity with whatever, what happens around you and even on the international level. So that's part of my personal experience.
Remind you, our goal, our in our union CGT, if I can sum up what he said, the solidarity is the lead to our movement to help people like Mumia. Solidarity, if union like CGT in France, who was always fighting for the best situation for workers in our country, cannot look at what is happening in a country near France or in Africa or in South or North America and defend people who are suffering more than we are. And if we cannot help them to free from what the government or the bad laws they are fighting with, there is no real reason to be a unionist, because a unionist is not only for workers in your country, but for everybody in the world.
Now I see why they didn't let you into the prison.
Maybe.
You said to me you were a communist. I think so, and I think that's wonderful.
I know that the three of you have been traveling around the U.S. and are here to address certain meetings. I wonder if you could tell us where you've been and what you've seen.
We flew from Paris on Friday. We first planned to visit Mumia on Sunday, but we, when our friend Joanna called the prison, make sure to confirm that we're on the list. And the prison said we're confirmed for Saturday. So that's, you've got to be very flexible, you know. So finally, we drove straight from the airport to Frackville, where Mumia's prison is, and we could visit him the next day. It was not very easy. You were kicked out. We kept us waiting, but finally we got in and we managed to talk with Mumia for 3 hours. One thing we should add is that Mumia always says something which is for all the people who are listening at the same time. He says, if I'm still alive, it's because I can feel the love of all these people around me. One other thing we ask people that to do at home for his birthday, for instance, in April, is to send him a postcard from the place where we live, not a birthday postcard. So he gets to know all the places in France, for instance, and we talk with him and say, oh, yes, this place is here. And it makes outside people real in a way for him, you know. That's very important. So we spend time with him. We fought with, you know, money to get him some food. We have very, very little food left because that's the pleasure when you visit prisoners. You can buy them some food. And because food otherwise is not too good. So we spent something like 3 hours with Mumia. We don't want to stay too long because he's stuck. He can't go back to his cell after. It's something very complicated. You must always keep in mind that you are the outsider. You are going out back to your life. And whatever wrong thing you did wrong in the prison, they are going to be punished for that. We must always keep this in mind. I don't keep them talking for too long because he gets tired also. He still has very itchy kinks. His skin, you know, and he can't sleep properly, so he gets very tired.
I'm sitting here with a new book that I have of Mumia. It's called Murder Incorporated, Empire, Genocide, Manifest Destiny, Dreaming of Empire. This is just book one, and it's thick and it's wonderful, and we've got this brilliant internationalist whose mind just leaps over all prison walls. And I'm wondering how much of the political ideas of Mumia through his commentaries, his prolific writing, his journalism, has that also affected and influenced the comrades in France? And indeed, you're going to have to then tell us something about the union movement, because it certainly is somewhat different than ours. Because while we have locals here who will support Mumia Abu-Jamal, the bulk of the union movement has a hard time in understanding beyond, if you will, bread and butter issues. And I'm not sure how much they understand of that these days. Maybe you can talk about the politics of Mumia and what that has meant to the French struggle, which you were all part of.
One of the issues for me, which is very important, is the fight against racism and solidarity, as I said earlier. This fight is one of the most important for us in our country, in our union. And I think what is fighting for more than 30 years in the death row, now in jail, all this description he's doing is writing about his condition and not paying attention only to him, but working for other prisoners, giving his time to write books and having a radio commentary. All this for us is very important. It shows that solidarity and collective fight for a better world is the main activity Mumia is doing, and it comes to join our movement. This is why we are so close to Mumia.
Jackie?
Je voulais dire d'abord qu'en France, le combat de solidarité pour Mumia s'est fédéré autour...
So the first thing, if so many people focus on Mumia because he has become an international symbol of the abolitionist movement, the anti-death penalty activist. That was the first focus. We have been, most of Mumia's book have been translated into French, so people know about Mumia's points of view on politics, mass incarceration, again, fight against capitalism and all that. So something that many people know, but also why they got so interested in the case of Mumia.
And Jackie said that the fight was also for human rights. And this is very important because it was one of the main stones of our fight to show solidarity to Mumia. And it was the start of big demonstration we had in Paris and the way we could help him.
We can't let you go without also talking about Macron has launched a virulent attack on organized labor. And many of the media around the world, as they do here, claims that the economic problems are the problem of organized labor as they eke out a wage and whatever benefits. But labor movements are much more aggressive and much more strong in France. Can you tell us what's happening now as there are threats of major strikes and a showdown with President Macron? And, of course, we know what Mumia would say about that.
We'll ask him next time. But I must say the real problem is not the workers or the unions or the strikes or the demonstration. But the real problem is Macron himself, by the antisocial law he's trying to put on the table. We can describe him as a French Margaret Thatcher. If we let him go, we're going to destroy all our social benefits, all our unions. Since the Second World War, we succeed. All this kind of activity we did to erase them. Today, we show the last demonstration in Paris just before we came here. More than 200 demonstrations took place in France. Nearly 500,000 people demonstrate in the street, of course, mainly in Paris, but everywhere in small and bigger towns, because people, they don't want the railways worker to be privatized. They don't want the public sector to be as we see in some countries where there are only private hospital, private transportation, and there is no more public spirit services. And that, I think French people are not ready to support that. And therefore, there were many of them in the street. And the next month, big demonstration nationwide, and national railway workers are going to start strike 3 days in a month, and then they will start again working, and they will try to stop the antisocial law that Macron is trying to impose in France.
You know, Patrick, we had talked before about the letter that the International Association of Journalists sent to the governor of Pennsylvania with regard to Mumia. What was your role in that, and what is the significance of the International Federation of Journalists coming out in support of Mumia?
Therefore, we are very proud that this letter was sent, and it was prior to this letter, the last World Congress we had in Angers, we vote for a motion to support Mumia. It was the international solidarity among journalists who expressed him at that time, where Claude and Jackie were with us during this Congress in Angers. Therefore, we decide not to let the things more, but we ask now our federation to show more solidarity from all the world, from the 600,000 members of this international federation, and then we decide to send a letter to the governor, Tom Ford.
Tell us more about the state of the French unions and what we need to understand to, frankly, inspire us here, just as perhaps Mumia has inspired the politics of our comrades in France.
I'll let it, Jackie, after, but I'll say one thing. I've been part of, I've been working with union organizers in the US, okay? And I've realized that there is such a difference between starting a union here and I started a union in France. Unions are part of French history. They have been part of the political history. They made French life what it is today. That's to say, free public school, free college education, more or less free hospital, national health service, you know. French people are not ready to give up welfare state. Of course, there will be discussion. Macron is very powerful, and part of the young people think it's the new generation, so that's the new event. I just can't tell. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's not going to be easy. And I think he should not forget that French people are used to have public services, and we want. We're not ready to give up just like this.
Oui, je voulais revenir par rapport à la question que vous avez posée sur Monsieur Macron pour dire deux choses. Qui n'était ni de gauche, ni de droite. Mais après ces quelques mois de présidence, on s'aperçoit qu'il est surtout de droite. Et être de droite...
So I want you to talk about Mr. Macron. He first said that he was neither a left-wing man or a right-wing man. He didn't belong to any party. After a few months in office, we realized that he really is a right-wing man. His first target is to cut down on the rights of French workers and even European workers who are working in France. As Patrick said, he's trying to just take to pieces the public services. And he's just ignoring, you know, know, constitutional right and democratic process. For the first time, there's no debate in parliament, you know. He just ignore them. He just want to have his own will. And even workers who voted for him are beginning to realize that it's not the man whom they thought he was. He criticized what former president did, whether socialist president or conservative president, but basically he's taking our whole institution to pieces. For a short time, people just watched and watched. Today, workers are taking to the street to fight back and tell Macron that they totally disagree. And it's start trying to destroy what made the unity of the French people. Progress, National Health Service, and workers' rights at work, union rights, union leaders, and all that.
Mumia is an internationalist. You people are, as we would always say here, the workers have nothing to lose but their chains, and Ken always adds,
We have a world to win.
And we do have a world to win. In the last, if you could give us just a minute or two about your trip to the MOVE sisters, who, of course, Mumia always supported and worked with. And then we're going to bring in, lurking in the background, Suzanne Ross to tell people how they can mobilize for Brother Mumia.
Yeah. So after visiting Mumia, we just jump into the car to make it work. And we had 400 more miles to drive because you've got to realize that the sisters in a prison which is next to Lac Erie at the Canadian border, these women are very, very strong, very good sisters. They are good workers, social workers in the prison, you know. And I don't know, it's part of a family. It's difficult. It's always get very emotional when you speak about her because next August, they will have spent 40 years in prison. Can you imagine?
No.
40 years.
Yes, no.
I'm worried about the three women left. Merle died in 1998. There's still Janine, Jeanette, and Debbie left. Debbie is very strong because she still have a husband in prison, but still alive. She has son, grandchildren. She has something to look to when she gets out of prison, because I'm sure she will. Janine, since her husband passed away 2 years ago, I think she is very tired. She finds it difficult to sleep. There are six women in a cell, plus the dog, which we are training for a year or 14 months. The prison get money for it. They get them as puppy, and when we get to 14 months or 15 months, they go to the training. So it's very heart-rending on top of everything because they take care of him. They must stay up at night, make sure, you know, the dogs are clean and all that. And after they just go away, but we'll never see them again. It's cruel all along, you know. And Janet is the last one, and it's hard for Janet because she has more or less no family apart from the MOVE people. Since last year, when we walked out, and she said, okay, Claude, I'm coming to France with you when I get out. And I say, yes, okay, no problem, Janet, okay. Great woman, we need support. They're going to be paroled soon in May, and we need letters of support to get out of this hell.
Suzanne, we have about 2 minutes left. Suzanne Ross.
Well, what a great show. To the hosts, congratulations, and the guests. I was fascinated listening. For those of you who are listening, please remember this is a campaign, an international campaign. There are demonstrations all over the world, from South Africa to London to Paris to many other countries, Berlin and many other places, plus many right here in the United States. It was packed with activities here in New York and in Philadelphia. The big date, listen carefully, everybody, is April 30th of this year. And that is the day when we get a decision, presumably, unless they delay again, and we know their procrastinating tactics. The big decision on whether there will be a chance to review the entire case and potentially open up the possibility of Mumia finally being freed. Please call 212-330-8029 if you want to go on the bus that day from New York to Philadelphia. Again, that's 212-330-8029, and please check the website that covers all of these activities internationally and this country. That's freemumia.com. Again, www.freemumia.com. Please join this struggle that represents so much around the whole world.
And you are?
And I am Suzanne Ross,
Claude Guillaume Pujol.
Jackie Orto.
Patrick Kamenka.
We're going to participate in the demonstrations on labor.
And
May 1st, of course. And we're going to dump Trump and Macron and free Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And all political prisoners.
Free them all. Thank you, dear comrades. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
We set out on a year-long journey to learn about LGBTQ people around the world.
I didn't want to write a book. Theater, you can change the ending at the last minute if you want to. Once it's a book, it's in stone. And I wasn't sure of anything.
Was that gender outlaw?
It was.
In the words of the great gay bard Walt Whitman, I am large, I contain multitudes.
Just a game of science coming.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Lucia Chappelle. Trinidad and Tobago top court jettisons anti-sodomy laws.
Portugal liberates official gender labels.
And radio heroes heralded for inspiring service.
All that and more this week as our 30th anniversary celebration continues on This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending April 14th, 2018. The sounds of celebration on the steps of the High Court of Trinidad and Tobago on April 12th as the announcement was made that Justice Devendra Ramparad had struck down the Caribbean nation's British colonial-era anti-sodomy laws. Sections 13 and 16 of the Sexual Offenses Act punish buggery and acts of serious indecency between two men with up to 25 years in prison. Ramparad cited Section 4 of the country's constitution, spelling out the protection of human rights, to support his decision. Trinidad and Tobago kept the antiquated anti-sodomy laws even after it gained independence from Britain in 1976. Activist Jason Jones, a native of the islands who now lives in London and has dual citizenship, has led the legal challenge. He charged in his lawsuit, filed in March 2017, that the ban on private, consensual, adult gay sex violated his constitutional rights to privacy, liberty, and freedom of expression. He's endured the sadly inevitable death threats for his troubles, as well as criticism from some other queer campaigners fearing a backlash, who say that since the laws are rarely enforced, now is not the right time to rock the boat.
According to local reports, the anti-gay sex laws technically remain in force until a final judgment is issued by the High Court in July. Minister of Legal Affairs Stuart Young immediately announced that the government would appeal Justice Ramparad's ruling. The local Newsday newspaper also reported that at least four equality activists were physically assaulted by a group of Muslim fundamentalists as celebrations on the steps of the High Court were winding down. However, no serious injuries were reported, and activists credited police officials for moving in quickly to break up the melee. Similar laws are also under review by the high courts of Botswana and Kenya.
Portuguese MPs have approved law changes to make it easier for people to change their legal gender. Until now, anyone who wanted to change gender on official documents had to present a medical report supporting the change and be at least 18 years old. The new gender law removes the medical report requirement and lowers the age of eligibility to 16. Conservative opponents objected to both changes, especially lowering the age to 16, pointing out that teens at that age cannot legally even drink or drive. Nevertheless, a bare majority of MPs celebrated passage after a vote of 109 to 106 with a standing ovation. The bill also included provisions outlawing so-called corrective surgery on intersex babies who are born with both male and female sex characteristics. The legislation awaits the expected signature of President Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa.
But lawmakers in Uganda are attempting to revive a proposal to punish private consensual adult gay sex with up to life in prison. The East African nation's constitutional court in 2014 overturned the Anti-Homosexuality Act that had passed Parliament in December 2013 to increase penalties for gay sex, including a life sentence for what it called aggravated homosexuality, repeated offenses, sex with a minor, or transmitting HIV through homosexual acts. A first draft of the measure in 2009, infamously known as the Kill the Gays Bill, punished aggravated homosexuality with execution. Parliament approved a motion this week to commend Speaker Rebecca Kandaga for standing firm against LGBT rights at recent international gatherings. Several MPs took the opportunity to urge their fellow lawmakers to resurrect the Anti-Homosexuality Act because same-gender love is uncouth and un-African. Activist Edwin Sassange of the African Equality Foundation begs to differ. It is well documented that Britain forced anti-gay laws to Uganda, he said, meaning that it is homophobia which is un-African or un-Ugandan, not homosexuality.
Updating the aftermath of the demotion by lawmakers in tourist-dependent Bermuda of the marriages of same-gender couples to domestic partnerships, a major cruise line has filed a second lawsuit challenging its legality. The House of Assembly, late last year, overturned a Supreme Court ruling that had declared the denial of civil marriage to same-gender couples to be unconstitutional. Passage of that measure made Bermuda the first nation in the world to repeal its existing marriage equality laws. U.S.-based Bermudian activist Roderick Ferguson filed the first salvo with his lawsuit earlier this year, challenging the legality of the Domestic Partnership Act of 2017. Carnival Cruises, one of the world's largest cruise ship companies, filed its own lawsuit last week, challenging the constitutionality of the Domestic Partnership Act. The fleet of the company and its subsidiaries, Cunard, Princess, and P&O, includes 24 ships registered in Bermuda. A press release from Carnival Cruises announced that it was partnering with the queer advocacy group Out Bermuda to file the second lawsuit. As a company committed to equality, inclusion, and diversity, the statement read in part, our engagement includes providing Out Bermuda with financial, civic, and public relations support. The cruise line said it would also lobby other travel businesses to join their lawsuit.
Meanwhile, the openly gay CEO of the Bermuda Tourism Authority said this week that the boycott of the island being vocally supported by Ellen DeGeneres and others would be highly counterintuitive to what people are trying to achieve. Kevin Dallas, who entered into a civil union with his partner in the UK years ago, admitted that he's got a vested interest in Bermuda's robust tourism industry, but that nothing makes a bigger difference to win hearts and minds than being present and visible. In an exclusive interview with Gay Star News, he also pointed out that the Bermuda he knows has a small but vibrant racially mixed LGBT community that includes workers in the tourism industry who would also be hurt by an economic boycott. When asked what message he had for LGBT travelers, he said that Bermuda's tourism industry clearly is committed to inclusivity and treating all visitors with respect. Our ambition, he added, is to reassure them that actually, regardless of the law, they are welcome.
In other news, yet another federal court has ruled that U.S. civil rights laws protect people in the workplace from discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Judge Lee Rosenthal of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Texas found that plaintiff Nicole Whitmer had grounds to sue the energy conglomerate Phillips 66 for refusing to hire her as an engineer because she's transgender. The judge made it clear that Whitmer had not proven that the company discriminated against her, but ruled that if it had, she would have a case under Title VII of the U.S. Civil Rights Act of 1964. That law bans discrimination based on sex. Judge Rosenthal joined a growing list of federal courts across the country, and it's the first such ruling in Texas, to determine that Title VII protects LGBT people. Some federal appeals courts have supported that view, while a few others have not. It's only a matter of time before at least one of these cases reaches the U.S. Supreme Court.
And finally, supporters of President Donald Trump are branding Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey an anti-Christian bigot for grilling Secretary of State nominee Mike Pompeo about his anti-queer views during confirmation hearings on April 12th. Booker pointed out that as Secretary of State, the former Kansas congressman and current Trump CIA director would be responsible, in part, for advancing the cause of human rights around the world, including LGBT rights. Fox News pundit Todd Starnes led the charge, accusing Booker of shaming Mr. Pompeo because of his deeply held religious beliefs. We think Booker gets an E for effort, while at best Pompeo earns an incomplete for dodging Booker's dogged questions. But you decide.
You said in a speech, mourning an America that endorses perversion and calls it an alternative lifestyle, those are your words. Is being gay a perversion?
Senator, I when I was a politician, I had a very clear view on whether it was appropriate for two same-sex persons to marry. I stand by that.
So you do not believe it's appropriate for two gay people to marry?
Senator, I continue to hold that view. It's the same view.
Do you believe that gay sex is a perversion? Yes or no?
Senator,
Do you believe that gay sex is a perversion? Because it's what you said here,
Senator,
one of your speeches. Yes or no? Do you believe gay sex is a perversion?
Senator, my respect for every individual, regardless of their sexual orientation, is the same.
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending April 14th, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazor, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Extra.
Have you checked our website lately?
For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show,
log on to
thiswayout.org.
Remember. This Way Out's 30th anniversary party is rocking all this month, and this week's special guests are some of the friends who usually bring the guests to us.
Our volunteer reporters and feature producers come from many different places and have lots of different reasons for their passion to share LGBTQ voices with you on the radio.
We could never say enough words to express our gratitude to our excellent volunteers.
So let's raise an anniversary toast to a few of them in their own words.
This is Maggie Young and Katie Cook, and we are the Sapphic Nomads. 4 years ago, we set out on a year-long journey to learn about LGBTQ people around the world. Through social media and friends of friends,
we were able to connect with people all over the globe. And in addition to doing interviews, we got to eat family meals with them, go to gay clubs with them, and even march on the streets with them. When people ask us what we learned on this journey, we often find ourselves talking about the various ways people felt they fit into a global LGBTQ movement. One interview we found particularly interesting was with Deepak Kashyap, a psychologist in Mumbai, India.
We don't have a culture of giving equal rights to people. Ha! You are an untouchable. You are the Shudras, and I am the Rajput, and I am the Brahmin, and I'm... So India's definition of equal is some people are more equal than others. This entire idea of equality is a Western import, and I would rather I import this.
Some people we interviewed also argued that the very labeling of LGBTQ is itself a Western idea. For example, in Samoa, there is the ancient tradition of what some refer to as a third gender identity. President of the Fa'afafine Association, Roger Stanley, explains.
Fa'afafine, or the type of people that we are, is very unique. It's a Samoan word. It derives from the word fafine, which is woman. Fa'a is become like a woman. Fa'afafine has always been here and always been around in Samoa during the pre-Christianity. We've been born biologically males, but we chose to become women because most of us feel that it's from inside, it's from the heart.
Setting off into our journey, we'd never imagined just how deep and rich the experience would be. And just as we've felt honored to meet and interview so many great people, we also have a profound gratitude for This Way Out and its vast and diverse network of listeners around the world. From Denver, Colorado, this is Maggie Young and Katie Cook for This Way Out.
Hi, this is John Frame from Brisbane, Australia, congratulating This Way Out, world-class LGBT support and entertainment. I'm proud to have been a regular contributor for nearly two decades.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
One of my favourite shared interviews was with Rufus Wainwright in January 2005 in the lead-up to an Australian tour he did with his family, the McGarrigle family.
When I started my career, the first thing I said to my record company, even before I sat down at the table, I said, I just want you to know, before we have this meeting, I am not pretending to be straight. I am going to be totally honest about my homosexuality. Because I was afraid that, you know, contractually they'd try to bind me into something. And then also, I mean, I have always really been excited by the history of gay culture and the real sort of tradition of high art and high standards, which you know, has existed for hundreds of years within gay culture. And I felt I was at a tremendous advantage because I could draw from that and you know, carry on that tradition. That has definitely fueled me and helped me.
For a song with a straightforward message, including the title, Gay Messiah, it does have the potential, I think, to offend people who want to be offended.
Yeah. That song's interesting to me because it's had three lives already. When I first wrote it, it was essentially a joke song. I mean, it was something to be sung at, you know, cocktail parties or, you know, to sort of liven up an audience and laugh a little. And then it became a bit of a protest song and, you know, was always followed by a plea, go out and vote in the next election, you know, because us gays are kind of in the line of fire here and are not appreciated by the majority of the Republican Party. And then after, unfortunately, the election was lost, the song then became a literal prayer for an actual gay messiah and for some sort of divine intervention. And I do kind of consider it in that weird way, like I do consider it like an actual prayer.
Then pray for yourself. Then pray for yourself. Cause the game of science comes.
This is John Frame from Brisbane, Australia.
I'm Dixie Treichel, a host on Fresh Fruit. I and my co-host, John Townsend, have delighted in sharing some of our locally produced material with This Way Out. Kate Bornstein was on tour performing and doing readings from her new memoir, A Queer and Pleasant Danger. While in Minneapolis, she talked with me about her theater and writing development and how she incorporates gender theory into her work.
My original art was theater. Theater is where I first write my pieces. Theater is where I come up with the ideas, because theater, live performance art, that's the scariest thing. Getting up in front of people and ripping your heart out and saying scary stuff about yourself and saying, can I still be a decent human being? That has been the basis of all my writings.
The very first book you ever wrote.
People pushed me on it. I didn't want to write a book. Theater, you can change the ending at the last minute if you want to. You can realize, hey, this isn't going so well, and change it and make it better. Once it's a book, it's in stone. And I wasn't sure of anything.
Was that Gender Outlaw?
It was. After Gender Outlaw came out and was a hit, so Routledge asked me right away, would you write another one? Then it turned into a child workbook format, my gender workbook. It was still trans theory. There was more in there about the impact of race, age, class onto the idea of trans. So that was a transformation in my writing. I was looking out beyond trans as a single issue. And then I toured around, and I was really getting tired of all the bullying I was seeing. That eventually became one chapter in the book, Hello, Cruel World. Mm-hmm. And so writing Hello, Cruel World was learning to write about the scariest stuff there is, death, your own, and doing it with love. So I was able to talk like from this elder point of view. For the first time, I called myself a crone in training while I was writing that book.
Kate Bornstein in Minneapolis. This is Dixie Treichel for This Way Out.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
I'm Margaret Cho.
This is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm Kate Clinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
I'm Clive Barker.
This is Judy Shepard.
Hello, this is Ian McKellen.
I'm Jerry Jewell.
I'm Stephen Fry.
I'm Harvey Milk.
Hi, this is Janice Ian.
My name's Robbie Rogers.
This is Essex Hemphill.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
I'm Tab Hunter.
I'm Billy Bean.
This is John Cameron Mitchell.
Hello, I'm Bruce Valanche.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson.
I'm Robbie Kaplan.
I'm Andrew Sullivan.
This is Augustine Burroughs.
I'm Barney Frank.
I'm Cleve Jones.
My name is Kate Kendall.
I'm Dan Savage.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, and you've discovered
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
The international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
How dare they?
Now I'm fascinated.
And those who love them.
Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
And that's the truth.
I wonder who wrote the book of life.
This is Janet Mason. I've been writing and recording commentary for This Way Out for almost two decades. I've long been intrigued by the intimate nature of radio. I have memories of being shaped by the radio. Early in life, as an adolescent, alone in my room in my parents' house, but connected to the world through the magic power of radio. When I first came out, I would listen to my local lesbian feminist radio show. Yes, I said lesbian feminist. It was that long ago. As a child, I discovered the world through books. It makes sense that I would want to keep those worlds alive by writing and recording commentary on literature, particularly literature that reflects queer life. A lot has changed, but some would say the more things change, the more they stay the same. Occupying queer space on the radio airwaves is important now as ever to the LGBT community. It has been my privilege to work with This Way Out to provide you with queer commentary over the years. Every now and then I hear from a listener, and always I am moved. Not only do I get to be part of an important LGBT vehicle for queer culture, but I get to be part of your world also. And being connected to the worldwide LGBTQ movement, I feel larger than myself. In the words of the great gay bard Walt Whitman, I am large, I contain multitudes. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
In the part of Amsterdam, in the part of Amsterdam.
This is the first legal civil marriage between two men or two women, and that is unique in the world.
Today I finally get to look at the man that I love and say, will you please marry me?
Yes to inclusion, yes to generosity, yes to love, yes to equal marriage.
Marriage equality has been one of the signature LGBT issues. Listen to how we marched down the aisle from the Netherlands to the U.S. to Ireland to Canada with coverage like this.
How the world can change, it can change like that, due to one little word, married.
Hello, This Way Out listeners. It's Heather Kitching here. And back in 2005, I covered for This Way Out the Canadian House of Commons vote to legalize same-sex marriage. I covered this from a pub in the LGBT village in Vancouver, where I was living at the time, because that's where queers in Vancouver went to watch the vote on TV. Queers in most provinces of Canada had already won same-sex marriage through the courts by this point, so this whole thing kind of felt a bit anticlimactic. But then I thought, this is still a historic moment. This is our democratically elected government affirming that same-sex couples are equal to straight couples. So at the last minute, I went. And of course, I'm very glad I did, because this is one of those moments that has gone down in history.
The question is the following one. Mr. Cotton, seconded by Mr. Peterson, moved that Bill C-38, an act respecting certain aspects of legal capacity for marriage for civil purposes, be now read a third time and do pass. In favor of the motion, will please rise. Monsieur Martel Salaman.
The crowd cheered when our supporters stood up to cast their votes. They booed when our opponents voted against us. And then it happened.
Nays pour 158, 158. Nays contre 133, 133.
I'm Heather Kitching.
I can't be contented with yesterday's glory. I can't live on promises, winter to spring to spring.
Listening to highlights from the work of some of This Way Out's volunteer producers over these last 30 years. Sapphic Nomads Maggie Young and Katie Cook live in Denver, where Maggie is a psychotherapist and Katie continues to do video documentary production.
Unofficially retired professional poof John Frame can be heard on 4ZZZ's Queer Radio in Brisbane and occasionally on This Way Out. He's also compiling an online archive of his radio work.
Dixie Trico co-hosts Fresh Fruit on KFAI Minneapolis with John Townsend and still contributes to This Way Out. Her audio documentaries and sound art compositions have also been broadcast internationally.
Queer Life and Lit commentator Janet Mason has just published her own new novel, They.
Now, who can we get to review Janet's book?
And Heather Kitching is now a reporter and associate producer with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and the managing editor of Roots Music Canada. That's rootsmusic.ca.
We'll raise a 30th anniversary glass to a few more stalwart volunteer producers as we continue our celebration all month long on This Way Out.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from John Dyer V and Tanya Kane Perry, with thanks to Brian DeShazer. We saluted journalist producers Maggie Young and Katie Cook, John Frame, Dixie Trico, Janet Mason, and Heather Kitching in our 30th anniversary flashbacks this week. Rufus Wainwright, the Monotones, Alan Cumming, and the New Christy Minstrels performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music.
This layout thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. We invite you to join our 30th anniversary party at the all-new thiswayout.org and play our 3430 game on Give Out Day, April 19th.
Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio at aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA.
Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org.
And on KFXU Antigonish, Nova Scotia.
WAZU Peoria, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, Phoenix, Arizona.
And more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the century from the Spanish-American War to the end of the Cold War, Washington had developed a distinctive form of global governance that incorporated aspects of antecedent empires, ancient and modern. This unique U.S. imperium was Athenian in its ability to forge coalitions amongst allies, Roman in its reliance on legions that occupied military bases across most of the known world, and British in its aspiration to merge culture, commerce, and alliances into a comprehensive system that covered the globe. Those words come from Alfred McCoy's examination of U.S. empire, titled In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power, which is published by Haymarket. McCoy holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and his many books include The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. Al, let me start by asking you for a working definition of the term empire. What does it mean as you see it?
In very simple terms, I think empire is a transnational form of governance in which a dominant power exercises control, usually without the consent of the governed, over somebody that's somehow defined as other, either a tribe or an ethnic group at the border of an expanding overland empire, or a wholly different kind of people in the case of a maritime empire.
You write that there are three phases in the history of the American empire, starting with the Spanish-American War, then the kind of apex of U.S. empire after World War II, and then the more recent years of U.S. empire in a bid to extend hegemony in ways such as cyber war. I wonder if you could start with the first and tell us about the first phase of American empire, the early ascendant years. What did it entail? What did U.S. empire look like?
It wasn't just the rise of the U.S. as an imperial power. After 1898, we saw the rise of the United States as essentially a world power. Not a major world power at that point, but a world power nonetheless. And in essence, after 1898, the United States went to war with Spain, the Spanish-American War. And as a result of that war, we conquered the island remnants of the once great Spanish empire. And that meant that we acquired Puerto Rico ultimately as a commonwealth. We had temporary sovereignty over Cuba that we gave up in 1903, although under the Platt Amendment we reserved the right to further intervention. And then subsequent to that, we acquired the Panama Canal. And as a result of the American planters in Hawaii and the intervention of the U.S. Navy, we picked up Hawaii in the 1890s. We picked up Guam, the Marianas, and then the Philippines. And so when that phase was all over, the United States had a sort of a tropical diadem of islands stretching from Puerto Rico almost halfway around the world all the way to the Philippines. And these were small colonies, in a sense, but they also served to have a profound impact upon the character of the American state. Because up to 1898, the scholar Steve Skowronek has described America as kind of a patchwork state, a fragmentary state. The U.S. federal government was quite weak, had very little capacity beyond Washington, D.C., beyond the nation's borders. And as a result of empire, the U.S. Acquired, if you will, kind of hothouses for experimentation in more coercive forms of governance. So that we built an agile army that was capable not just of defending the coasts and a few scattered dusty outposts out west, but actually being mobilized and sent anywhere in the world, as we were to the Philippines and to Beijing for the Boxer Rebellion, etc. We developed very quickly a blue water navy. The Great White Fleet circumnavigated the globe and returned home in 1909, the first fleet to sail around the globe. And then the other thing that happened, and this is, I think, emblematic of the character of U.S. empire. Beginning in 1907, the man who was the architect of the empire, the former Secretary of War and then Secretary of State, Elihu Root, sent an American delegation to the Second Hague Peace Conference, and he gave them a two-part mandate. One was to establish international laws for the for war, the rules of the laws of war. And second, he instructed the delegation, if possible, to encourage the formation of a world court, an international court. And Root devoted the next, really, the rest of his life, all the way up to 1934, when he was in his 80s, pressing for the development of that court and the U.S. incorporation, the U.S. recognition of the court. And so what we saw is the United States, to sum it up, the first phase, as a colonial power, we gained these kind of hothouses for experimentation and aggressive coercive governance. We developed our first internal security apparatus in the Philippines that we brought home during World War One. And second, we developed a more idealistic strand of U.S. foreign policy, the idea that there should be an international community of nations governed by the rule of law. That was the first phase. The second phase that you mentioned, as a result of World War II, elevated the United States to an extraordinary position of power, not just one power among many. In fact, back in 1900, we were a distinct secondary power. Suddenly, we were the world's preeminent power. For one thing, the other major centers of industry, the Soviet Union, Japan, and Western Europe, were absolutely ravaged. So at the end of World War II, we had something like 50% of gross world product was produced by the United States. Moreover, we had an army 16 million strong that had defeated two of the world's most powerful empires. The Japanese Empire, in terms of population, was the biggest empire in human history. And the Nazi Empire, along with its allies, was the first to ever conquer and occupy the whole of Europe. Neither lasted very long. That's thanks to the U.S. But we defeated these two, empires, and we stood like a titan astride the globe. And right after World War II, we did two things. One, we built the raw realpolitik of power, a global military that by the mid-1950s had about 500 bases worldwide, a growing military that was developing a formidable nuclear capacity. We had a very active diplomacy that was negotiating multilateral and bilateral security and trade pacts around the globe. We also developed one of the most distinctive aspects of U.S. global governance, one that really distinguishes the United States from every empire that preceded it, the covert dimension. The CIA grew right after World War II into an extraordinarily powerful agency. Its attempts to penetrate behind the Iron Curtain inside the People's Republic of China, the Soviet Union, were abysmal failures. And as the CIA recoiled under President Eisenhower from these one disaster after another, they discovered that they were, by contrast, very effective in policing and controlling the 100 new nations that were emerging from the decolonization by a half dozen European maritime empires, Belgium, Britain, France, Portugal. And so the CIA became a key mechanism for the U.S. exercise of global power because there was a delicate duality to U.S. global power at the end of World War II. One was that raw realpolitik. The other was the realization of Elihu Root's idealistic vision of a community of nations governed by the rule of law. So at the end of the war, the United States convened the San Francisco Conference to establish the United Nations. And as a part of that UN charter, they created an international court at The Hague. Prior to that, they convened the Bretton Woods Conference that established the World Bank. In effect, the United States created this incredibly ambitious and idealistic vision of an international community of sovereign nations. Every person would have citizenship in a nation that enjoyed untrammeled sovereignty. And this community of sovereign nations would be governed by the rule of law. Well, of course, there's a contradiction between the realpolitik of a global empire of untrammeled military, economic, and covert power and this ideal of a of a world of sovereign nations that have inviolable sovereignty which cannot be intervened in. So how do you intervene when you can intervene? How do you exercise hegemony when you can't? You do it covertly. And that's what gave the CIA and the NSA and the entire U.S. intelligence community its extraordinary power during the Cold War, and make covert operations a central facet, a distinguishing facet of U.S. imperial power.
That's the voice of Alfred McCoy. He is the author of In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in tracing the apex of American power following World War II, when, as you say, all other rivals were really left in ruins, and these new systems were put in place, the formal structures that you were describing, and then, of course, these deep covert networks of influence and undermining power as it's exercised in other parts of the world. How do you understand, you mentioned Bretton Woods and the establishment of the World Bank, and of course the whole framework, economic framework for the post-war period was established through Bretton Woods with the United States at the center. How do you understand that aspect, trade pacts and so on, as vehicles for the exercise of U.S. power?
Yeah, the economic dimension of U.S. power, of course, went along with that extraordinary array of diplomatic influence and military power. The U.S. created the multinational corporation. We began operating beyond our borders more expansively, more aggressively than any other power had, except for the United Kingdom in its day. The idea of Bretton Woods, which created the General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs, or Tariffs and Trade, that later became the World Trade Organization, created, if you will, a mechanism by which nations could supposedly trade in open international markets. And at the time, the U.S., of course, was the preeminent power economically. We had the best technology. We had the vibrant industrial complex. So opening up the world to global trade, of course, advantaged the United States. And, of course, it also created a mechanism for other rising powers, such as China, to gain a foothold in the international economy. So what we saw was at the end of World War II, the United States, as I said earlier, had about 50% of gross world product. And then by 1960, it was down to about 40%. And today, it's somewhere around 20%. And if you take what's called purchasing power equity, the value of what you can buy for a dollar in the U.S. versus what you can buy, let's say, in China, we may already be down to about 15 or 16%. So that's a pretty a marked decline in the U.S. share of the global economy. And our economic influence has begun to decline correspondingly.
Staying with the post-war years, what was the effect domestically of U.S. empire on dissent?
During our intervention in the Philippines in 1898, we were trying to break not just an anti-colonial revolt against Spain, but a national revolt. The Filipinos had imagined a new nation. They wrote a constitution. They mobilized an army. They defeated Spain, and then we, as a result of the Spanish-American War, sailed into Manila Bay and began the brutal pacification of the Philippine Islands. Well, in order to meet that, to crush that resistance that dragged on for a decade, the U.S. Army discovered the power of intelligence, of counterintelligence, and they built the first field intelligence unit in the history of the U.S. Army, and they conducted massive and systematic surveillance of the Philippine population. The guy who was the head of that unit was a former medical officer named Captain Ralph Van Diemen. And when World War One broke out and the U.S. entered that war in 1917, the U.S. Army was the only army on either side of the battle lines that didn't have an intelligence service of any description. And so the Army asked then-Colonel Van Diemen to establish the military intelligence of the U.S. Army. He quickly built up, it was actually he built up a counterintelligence unit of 1,700 soldiers and a citizens vigilante group, an extraordinary organization of badge-carrying Americans called the American Protective League that had 350,000 badge-carrying members, and they conducted a massive counterintelligence against suspected German-American subversion. They were the largest ethnic group in the United States at that time, and we were, of course, at war with their nominal homeland, and there was concern about their loyalty. And so this was a massive counterintelligence operation that introduced the craft of counterintelligence in the United States. Van Diemen ran it in collaboration with a then very fragmentary, very nascent FBI, and that grew into a national counterintelligence apparatus of extraordinary dimensions. And so during the Cold War, Hoover, who took over the counterintelligence from the Army and from Van Diemen, that was a division made at the start of World War II. Hoover, during World War II and in the aftermath, ran a very aggressive counterintelligence operation that actually the COINTEL, the counterintelligence program, top secret, very confidential, never really fully examined by the FBI, during the 1950s, late 50s through the mid-1970s, when it was finally exposed, conducted, according to the FBI's own history, their own website, over 2,000 illegal actions were undertaken by the FBI under the COINTEL program. So there was massive repression during the Cold War that accompanied that civic mobilization in support of the U.S. as a global power.
I was struck in reading your account of the publication of your book, it came out in 1972, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, about the very long reach of the CIA into all dimensions of public life in the United States. I wonder if you could tell us the story of that book and the reception that you received as emblematic of the kind of very long reach of the security state into publishing, into journalism, and so on.
Sure. Very simply, let me sort of recap the book. In 1971, when I was a graduate student at Yale University, then 26 years old, I decided to investigate the origins of the heroin that was sweeping through the U.S. Army in South Vietnam in that year. Later, a survey done by the White House discovered that, about 34% of all U.S. troops serving in South Vietnam in 1970 and 71 were heroin addicts. And if that survey is of 1,000 veterans right after the war is accurate, there would have been probably more heroin addicts in the U.S. Army in South Vietnam than there were in the United States at that point. The drug problem was fairly small domestically then. So I went to Southeast Asia to investigate the source of drugs. Where is the heroin coming from? And who was supplying the U.S. Army? And what I discovered was that our Southeast Asian allies were supplying the commander-in-chief of the Royal Laotian Army, that was a U.S. ally, got nearly 100% of his military budget from U.S. aid, that he was running the world's largest heroin lab, and that cliques, military cliques at the very apex of the South Vietnamese government were smuggling the drugs from Laos into South Vietnam and distributing it to the troops nationwide. And when I came back to publish that book was in press at my publisher, Harper & Row, now HarperCollins. When I got a call from my publisher summoning me to New York to meet with the president of Harper & Row, and they advised me that a man named Cord Meyer Jr. had paid a social call on an old friend, the president emeritus of the company, and had demanded that the book be suppressed, saying that it was a threat to U.S. national security, that it was grossly inaccurate. And so who was Cord Meyer Jr.? Cord Meyer Jr. at that point in 1970 was one of the most powerful men in the covert netherworld of the CIA, where the CIA met the American publishing industry. He joined the CIA in the early 1950s. He was personally recruited by the director, Alan Dulles. He was quickly assigned something called Operation Mockingbird, which penetrated U.S. media using them for disinformation to advance U.S. covert operations overseas, basically planting stories in the press that the CIA wanted to see published. And Kortmeyer Jr. ran that operation. He also was responsible for funding the Congress of Cultural Freedom, the National Students Association, and so he had an enormous amount of power. Moreover, he was in the New York Social Register, a graduate of Yale. He was married. He had been married to Mary Pinchot Meyer, who was the daughter of an extraordinary influential family. Gifford Pinchot, her uncle, was the founder of the U.S. Forest Service, former governor of Pennsylvania. So he was an amazingly well-connected man. At the apex of the CIA, he was number two in CIA covert operations. And so I tried to resist. Harper told me that if I didn't agree to give the CIA prior review of my manuscript, it wouldn't be published. So I reluctantly agreed under terms that limited what the CIA could do. And ultimately, the manuscript was published unaltered. But that wasn't the end of it. I learned that my telephone was being tapped by the FBI. I've since gotten my FBI file. It was under fairly close surveillance. When the book was published in August of 1972, two things happened. One, I got a front page review, very favorable, in the New York Times Book Review. That's never happened to me since. And the other thing was I got a letter from Yale University putting me on academic probation. And Kortmeyer Jr. was an alumnus of Yale, and at that point, Yale was extraordinarily close to the CIA. Many of the top officials in the CIA were Yale graduates, and like former CIA Director Porter Goss, you know, he was a junior at Yale, and he was called into a professor's office and told that he had a special talent and he should go someplace and wait for somebody to approach him with a code word, and off he went into the CIA. So Yale had extraordinarily close ties to the CIA at that time. And so they also, you know, former friends began approaching me in a kind of curious way. And what I realized was that, you know, the CIA had the capacity to reach into the life of a 27-year-old graduate student and influence my publisher, my phone. I got a tax audit. I had a poverty-level graduate student income. I got a tax audit in poverty. My friendships, everything. You know, every single aspect of my life, they could penetrate. And so it wasn't a standing overt apparatus like the KGB or something like that in a truly authoritarian state. It's what you might call just-in-time repression. You know, when they needed it, they had the capacity to pull the strings and to affect the outcome they wanted. And I guess looking back on that, I hadn't realized the depth of penetration of the U.S. covert apparatus into American society during that period. It's an unappreciated feature of the Cold War.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Alfred McCoy about his book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. That's published by Haymarket, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and his many books include The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. So, taking things closer to the present, when we hear about the mass surveillance, the extent of which was made clear by Edward Snowden with his revelations in 2013, that the National Security Agency was gathering massive amounts of data on Americans, that, I think, provoked outrage in many quarters, and seemed the advent of new technology like it might be something unprecedented. But one of the things that comes through in your book, In the Shadows of the American Century, is that the way the United States has operated as an imperial power has actually a lot of continuity over periods of time. So what you were just describing, about your experience with the CIA and the surveillance state. How do you make sense of that period of time, the period of time of the Cold War, of the 60s, of the 70s? COINTELPRO obviously was part of the picture. With the kind of surveillance now, is there a qualitative difference? Is there a quantitative difference? How do you make sense of the continuity and rupture?
At the peak of our power in the 1960s and 70s, the U.S. could exercise its power covertly because we had such an asymmetrical balance of power with the rest of the world. Our economy was so strong, our military was so massive, our diplomatic presence was so pervasive that we could mount covert operations very quickly, very effectively. Carnegie Mellon University did an excellent survey a few years ago, and they surveyed all elections from 1945 to the year 2000, and they documented that the United States intervened in about 80 consequential elections worldwide that they could determine. And when you think about it, that's really an extraordinary level of electoral interference. Beginning, let's say, with keeping the communists out of power in the 1948 Italian elections, all the way to the attempts to manipulate the 1970 elections, the 1973 elections in Chile to, first of all, keep Allende out of power, and then, second of all, check his legislative mandate, both of which fail. And then when those electoral interventions failed, the CIA often used its assets through U.S. military training and U.S. military aid to foment military coups. And between 1958 and 1975 or so, about three dozen nations worldwide had a change of government as a result of military coup, and the CIA was behind most of those. In effect, by covert intervention in elections and covert involvement in coups, the United States had the capacity to influence who would sit in the presidential palace or the premiership of countries around the globe on our side of the Iron Curtain. And nations that tried to resist that, like the Allende government did famously, would find themselves of a target of a really massive, sustained U.S. effort that entailed the manipulation of military allies, a virtual economic blockade, being cut off from international finance, the World Bank, Inter-American Bank, every possible source of finance. In other words, the U.S. had an extraordinary power to bring to bear to topple a government when it wanted to. With the end of the Cold War, for a while the U.S. stood astride the globe again like a titan, but very quickly that seeming unprecedented power began to slip away, and I think it has to do with that longer-term economic shift that we talked about earlier. The U.S., again, shifting from having something like 50% of the world economy back in 1945 down to about 20% today. And with each percentage point of the drop, the U.S. influence began to fade. And I think that under Obama, there was a recognition that maintaining this massive heavy metal military arrayed around the Eurasian landmass to defend our geopolitical position was going to be costly and difficult, and although Obama was determined to do that as much as he could, he cut down the cost he imposed at one point, a 14% reduction in infantry. He continued a drawdown of the U.S. Navy to about 280 ships at the close of his administration, half the size that it had been at the peak of the Cold War. He made a strategic shift to what you might call low-cost, high-effectiveness instruments of U.S. global power. He discovered cyber warfare. The U.S. Cyber Command was established in 2009. The U.S. military declared cyberspace to be a domain of conflict, air, land, sea, and cyberspace. Army, Navy, Air Force, Cyber Command. Moreover, the U.S. was rapidly weaponizing space. one of the unappreciated aspects of U.S. global power was that starting in 1967, when the U.S. launched the first global telecommunication satellite system, you know, we were the first nation on the planet to make space an adjunct of our military power. By the 1990s, all command, control, and communications for all U.S. forces everywhere in the world on air, land, and sea was being done by satellite. And no other nation, I mean, there was a European Space Agency, you know, nations were shooting up individual satellites either on their own or under contract, but nobody had this sustained presence of a global satellite system that did everything for its military. And so the Obama administration built on that. They established a space command, and they made space another domain of conflict. And I think there was a sense that the U.S. could build a kind of robotic information regime involving satellites, space drones, biometric identification, stratospheric drone strikes, that would gird the globe in a very efficient technology. Moreover, that through cyber warfare, we would be able to do things like the Stuxnet attack on the Iranian nuclear program that knocked out something like 20% of their centrifuges. Very cost-effective. That was, I think, the aspiration, the hope. The United States would have this lethal technological edge that would allow us to continue our global dominion for another generation or two. But, of course, technology, once discovered, begins to proliferate. And there are all kinds of indicators, I mean, of the relative U.S. technological decline. I mean, at one point, our cyber capacity far exceeded any other nation on the planet. But we've seen, for example, Russia has become very effective in cyber warfare. They crashed Estonia's computers 2007. A year later, they crashed Georgia's computers. In their recent conflict with Ukraine, they took out the Ukrainian electrical system. They're believed to have hacked into much of the U.S. electrical grid to try and just develop the tools to take us out if they wish to. And then let's not forget the 2016 election, when Russia's, you know, bots and its Internet Bureau in St. Petersburg essentially turned cyberspace into an instrument of destabilization of the U.S. elections, disseminating scandal, disinformation, and destabilization. And that, to me, is a sign of a fading U.S. power, because global hegemons manipulate other people's elections. A declining superpower discovers one day that its own elections are being manipulated.
So does that mean that when we look at empires in decline, is the telling dimension of it that the imperial power no longer is on the technological cutting edge? Or is it something more deeper-seated about that empire itself?
Well, I think, you know, the decline in comparative advantage of military technology is both a cause and a consequence of that decline. And it's also inherent in the nature of the technology. These technologies, cyberspace, cyber warfare, are readily accessible. The Iranians, which are, you know, a struggling economy and a second-tier power, they've got a very sophisticated cyber war operation. You know, we hacked into their nuclear campaign, but a few years ago, we were flying, the CIA was flying this amazing drone, the RQ-170, known as the Beast of Kandahar, because of its secret takeoff and landings at Kandahar Air Base in Afghanistan. They hacked into the GPS system, and they walked that CIA drone to land in one of their own bases and put it on display in Tehran for the international media. I mean, it was an extraordinary blow. This was the most sophisticated CIA drone, the kind of U-2 of its day. And Iran, you know, not Russia, not China, Iran hacked it. And another example, I mentioned that, you know, from 1967 until right now, we're the only power on the planet that had a global, truly global telecommunication satellite system. Well, in about 2 years, China's going to be the second power on the planet with a global telecommunications satellite system. And then another change, and again, this is just on the public record. There may be secret research that nobody knows about, except those who are written in. But China just about a year ago announced that they developed photon satellite communication. In other words, from ground stations, they could shoot a photon up to their satellite. And because there's a unique transmitter, unique receptor, this is a system of communication that's absolutely impervious to hacking. We're still using microwave signals, which, as we saw with that Iranian capture of the CIA's drone, are subject to hacking and manipulation. So it looks like, one of the critical areas of satellite communications and satellite security is having absolutely secure communications. So it looks like China may be stealing a march on us in that area. So there are all kinds of signs that this overwhelming U.S. power in space and cyberspace that 10 years ago was certainly clear, that's fading very, very fast.
I'm speaking with historian Alfred McCoy. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. In your book, In the Shadows of the American Century, you suggest that the final days of the U.S. as an empire could come sooner than most of us would imagine. And in your book, you look at a number of scenarios in which you could imagine the end to come. Tell us about those.
Well, the thing to watch is the geopolitics. At the end of World War II, as Oxford historian John Darwin said, the United States became the first power in history to gain control of both ends of Eurasia. And Darwin said that in a magisterial work that surveyed the history of imperial conflict on the Eurasian landmass over the span of 600 years. And what he was talking about was that we controlled the axial ends of Eurasia. Beginning in 1949 through the NATO alliance, we had a rock-solid anchor in the West. And then 2 years later, in 1951, we signed four bilateral mutual defense pacts with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia. So along that island chain, that Pacific littoral, we had the eastern anchor. And then throughout the Cold War, we lay down successive circles of steel between those two anchors. First of all, mutual defense pacts, stretching from NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, all the way down to CETO, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, and then those bilateral pacts along the littoral that I mentioned earlier. And then we had five massive fleets, the Sixth Fleet in the Mediterranean, later the Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea, and the massive U.S. Seventh Fleet based at Subic Bay, Philippines. There were, by the end of the Cold War, we had 1,700 fighters, we had 1,000 ballistic missiles, and, as I said earlier, the world's only system of global telecommunications satellite. We absolutely dominated Eurasia. We controlled it. The China and Russia were locked up behind the Iron Curtain, and we ranged around that perimeter, dominating that continent. And one of my scenarios entails, basically, there are several manifestations of it, but the key thing to look for is the waning of U.S. control over those axial ends of Eurasia and China's integration of Eurasia into an integrated economic bloc that can transcend U.S. power. Not only unify the interior of Asia, as they're doing through a $1 trillion infrastructure project, but also cutting through those circles of steel in the South China Sea and in the Arabian Sea that the United States laid down. And more than any particular scenario, and there are many of them, U.S. economic decline, climate change eroding our ability to maintain our overseas bases, a war with China, which even now the RAND Corporation based in Santa Monica, the ultimate insider think tank, very close relationship with the Defense Department and the Air Force, they did a survey called War with China in which they concluded that at this point we can't be certain who would win. Well, in a few years, if that war is fought in, as it's likely to be fought, somewhere in the South China Sea or the East China Sea, China has, of course, the advantage of proximity. So the outcome could be negative for the United States. But the key thing is whether it comes through economic competition, over conflict, military conflagration, large or small, the key thing to watch for is the waning of the U.S. control over Eurasia. One of three men in the last 120 years, whom I regard as a geopolitical grandmaster, the first was Elihu Root that I mentioned earlier. The last was Barack Obama that I discussed very briefly, and I can talk about his geopolitical strategy for checking China if you want. But the man who played the geopolitics of the Eurasian landmass like a grandmaster was Zbigniew Brzezinski, the national security advisor to President Carter. And as a national security advisor to Carter in the late 1970s, he launched Operation Cyclone, which grew into a massive CIA covert operation for driving radical Islam like a spear into the heart of Soviet Central Asia, and then in a geopolitical masterstroke, 3,000 miles to the west, shearing away Eastern Europe, liberating the satellite powers of Eastern Europe, those 14 nations. And then in retirement in 1998, Brzezinski wrote a book that's since been translated, I think, into something like 19 languages. It's his masterwork on the global chessboard. And he says that U.S. geopolitical power will remain as long as three conditions are preserved. One, NATO in the West is preserved. Two, the bases in the East are preserved, that other axial end. And third, no power will unify the great center of Eurasia. Well, of course, China is unifying through its trillion-dollar infrastructure project and its massive Asian Infrastructure Development Bank is unifying Eurasia economically. And those four bilateral or mutual security pacts with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia, those are weakening, and that pillar is crumbling. So, in essence, two of the conditions for the preservation of U.S. global power that Brzezinski saw are crumbling. Now, why is Eurasia so important? Well, simple fact of the matter, 70% of the world's population is in Eurasia. 70% of its resources, 70% of the global economy, they're in Eurasia. So if you're going to control the world, if you're going to be a global hegemon, you control Eurasia. That's the contest. From a geopolitical perspective, you know, there's some outlying islands, Greenland, Iceland, North America, South America, but the epicenter of global power is Eurasia.
Do you think that Trump will hasten the decline of the U.S. as an empire, or is he not so consequential in the grand scheme of things?
Well, let me answer that by first of all talking about very quickly about Obama's plan for the preservation of U.S. global power. Obama is, again, the third of what I call these geopolitical grandmasters, Elihu Root, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and Barack Obama. Obama had a very simple and I think rather incisive two-part strategy. One, he said that because of the North American energy revolution, Canadian tar sands, U.S. fracking, U.S. energy surplus, that we no longer had a strategic interest in the Middle East other than maintaining a certain rudimentary stability. So he proposed pulling all surplus U.S. forces out of that tar pit in the Middle East and rearranging them along the Pacific littoral, rebuilding our mutual security alliances with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia. And he was very successful in doing so. He got a U.S. base in Darwin. He got the Philippine government to agree to allow us to use five of their bases for our forces. He strengthened the Korean and Japanese alliance. And under Obama, the Pentagon planned to forward base 60% of U.S. naval and air forces along with cyber and space assets in the Pacific by 2020. The other part of Obama's strategy was very deft geopolitically. He was acutely aware that China was laying down $1 trillion of infrastructure to tie Europe and Asia into a unitary infrastructure for trade, investment, and development. Further, that China will spend by 2025 another $1 trillion in dominating Africa economically. drawing those three continents into a unified landmass. And so what Obama did was a strategy. First of all, he courted African leaders assiduously. It wasn't some, you know, romantic journey back to his childhood. This was raw geopolitics. Second, he pushed two treaties very hard, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. The Trans-Pacific Partnership would redirect 40% of world trade towards the United States. The Transatlantic Partnership would redirect another 20%. In effect, 60% of world trade would be drained out of Eurasia, leaving China with a kind of a hollow shell of infrastructure, but no lifeblood coursing through those pipelines, rails, and roads. Instead, all that trade and commerce and power would be crossing the Atlantic and Pacific towards America. And what has Trump done? Well, as we know, during his first week in office as his kind of, you know, housewarming present to the world, he canceled the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Well, you know, within recent weeks, the other 11 surviving partners have you know, authorized that treaty. They're going ahead. And even Trump himself, I don't think he's going to do it, but he said, gee, maybe that was a mistake. You know, we're going to reverse that. We should try and think about joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And, of course, the Transatlantic Partnership died a natural death, even just it was dying, actually, even before Obama left office. The other thing that Trump has done is that I think he's damaged those two axial ends of Eurasia. Last year in 2017, he made two major world trips. In May, he went to Europe, and he appeared at NATO headquarters, and he chastised the stone-faced NATO allies for their failure to pay their fair share. And then he did something fundamentally important. He refused to endorse the principle of common defense. That's to say, if one NATO member is attacked, all the others will help defend that NATO partner. Without common defense, there is no NATO. And although the White House said, we're oversight, of course we mean it, nonetheless, his refusal to do that on the spot in front of all the NATO leaders sent shockwaves through Europe and signaled. After that, Angela Merkel made a statement about Germany and Europe must seek their own destiny. And then in his November visit to Asia, when he spoke in front of the Asia-Pacific Economic Coordination in Vietnam, he gave this full-throated defense of his America First policy of, you know, basically bilateral trade agreements and unilateral advantage by the United States. The other 11 Trans-Pacific partners met separately and announced that they would be proceeding. Xi Jinping spoke glowingly about the benefits of world trade and looked like the global leader that the United States had once been. And then, of course, I mean, if you look at the individual relations with those, with Australia, the Philippines, South Korea, and Japan, all of those relations with those four powers have been badly damaged by Trump's outbursts and inept diplomacy. In effect, the two axial ends of Eurasia that were the anchors of U.S. geopolitical power and dominion over that vast continent for the past 70 years are, under President Trump, crumbling. And his diplomacy, if you can call it that, is accelerating that decline.
Let me just end by asking you about the domestic consequences of the end of the U.S. as an empire. What might it look like for people in the United States?
Well, the most visible thing I think is likely to happen is that the cost of real goods in the United States, our wages are low, our housing's expensive, but the things that people buy, food, clothes, consumer durables, they're the cheapest anywhere in the world. And I think that's a product of the U.S. dominion over the global economy and also the fact that the dollar is the global reserve currency. Right now, when we decide we're going to hand out tax cuts and increase federal spending for everything from the military to social welfare and education, we can just send the world our brightly colored treasury certificates, and they'll continue to send us these products at an exchange rate that makes them very cheap domestically in the United States. So I think one of the first things that's going to happen is that will probably start coming to an end. And when you think about how working people, poor people, depend on low-cost food, clothing, gasoline, motor vehicles, second-hand, third-hand maybe, but nonetheless, working motor vehicles to get around, to get to a job, to keep themselves clothed and fed, the costs of increasing that are going to really rock the American social contract and produce, I think, severe tensions for a while. Moreover, I think the kind of rhetoric that we saw in 2016, the anger over, you know, I mean, let's not forget, my friend Tom Englehart at Tom Dispatch says that Donald Trump is the first American declinist to run for public office. Remember, his slogan, make America great again. Well, hold it just a second. Again? I mean, in other words, we're not great? Yeah, that's what he was saying to his constituency, that we're declining, that China's robbing us, that people are taking your money and your jobs and your industries away from you. And that kind of raw populist anger and that very bitterly divided politics and the antagonism in the public sphere that everybody talks about, now, I think that's likely to get worse. So declining standard of living, increasing political division, political acrimony, political tensions.
Alfred McCoy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. That's published by Haymarket. Alfred McCoy's other books include Policing America's Empire. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.